A living hell that time forgot. This is the man who brought them to face the terrors of the past. His life could end here. Now the horrors from the past meet headlong with the terrors of the future. You will see torture pits for forbidden lovers. Barbaric sacrifice. No! Monster weed attack helpless beauty. Seed. Giant mollusks. See them fight to the death.
This is, well, Bristol, but also I'm still in Croatia, back next week, I hope. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. And the date today is Friday the 20th of September 2024. So we're on the live on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton in Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is available free from all good app stores. Please use Aurora and then disable Google Play. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators, and hatchet jobs on the heroes, like we heard Mohammed El-Fayed today. Hatchet jobs on him and character assassination extraordinaire. Of course, now he's dead and he can't fight back through the courts, which of course he would have done because he's was a very wealthy man, and he knew how to use the legal system to get people who are out to get him, like Private Eye, for example, over the years under Ian Hislop, was just attacking him again and again and again. So yes, the hatchet jobs on the heroes like Mohammed El-Fayed and Dodi Fayed. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the World War III and wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, those so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, prisons, cost of living, climate, twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse. And the politicians have nothing to say. Well, a bit special this week. Albert Pike's World War III relies on your blind obedience. Meanwhile, wife murdering Pantheist West King Tampon Charlie and the vampire queen Carmilla wage war on the British people as well as on China, Russia and the BRICS through their latest glove puppets. We'd look what crawled out of the recycling bin, panda-eyed energy saboteur Ed Miliband. But it's not the end of the world, or is it? So anyway, helping us navigate the accelerationist West Fourth Reich matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week, we'll be looking at the attempt to dismantle UK policing. So we've got Met Chief Constable Mark Rowley this week making a speech at the Police Foundation, trying desperately to say, look, if you don't change things, policing in London is going to collapse. Maybe he's just fishing for some more money, but maybe he's got a point. We have John Wedger this week, the whistleblower from the Scotland Yard as a vice squad detective, talking about that. We also got the sad demise of TNT Radio, which we're going to start with this week. They're closing today. They've been going for quite a while, putting out some very good stuff. And then, of course, the El-Fayed business, the character assassination of him. We're going to be listening this week to a similar thing, which was the character assassination of Michael Jackson. It's Candace Owen that's done a brilliant piece on him, and we'll have a little featurette on that, a bit on COVID, an update on that. So there's some very interesting information out recently about what is the best thing to do in order to try and help your body fight the COVID jabs if you've already had them. All very well for people to gloat and saying, well, I've not had the jab. But that's not very nice, is it? What about people that have had and they now regret it? So we've got also a poem on that. And in part two, the Pager Wars is the latest horrific provocation by Israel against Lebanon. The Lebanese are actually saying to the Israelis, right, we're ready to invade us, but that isn't going to happen. It's unlikely. What the Israelis want to do is just lob loads of bombs over, use their aircraft to bomb Lebanon, because they just want to attack and they don't actually want the territory of Lebanon, maybe. They just want to kill as many Lebanese as they possibly can without actually risking anything, using their advantages in technology. So then there's also this Trump assassination attempt, very interesting stuff on that, and the UN General Assembly vote in New York City on Wednesday, 124 for it, 14 against, quite a lot of abstention. So we'll be having a good old look at that. So first of all, Martin, before we start plunging to looking at the police and policing this week, because of Mark Rowley's interesting talk, what do you make of the way policing is going? It seems to me as if the organised crime has slowly but surely, through Freemasonry and other things, infiltrated the police. And they're now in the process of basically trying to close the police down.
Well, I mean, policing is a huge topic because it covers everything from local community police officers knocking on your door saying there's been a report of some altercation in here, right up to the intelligence services running rings around the police when it comes to major terrorist incidents. So you can't generalise about these things without going into specifics, is what I would say.
So do you think in your lifetime policing has changed? I mean, one of the things we're going to be looking at right now is the cut in police stations. One thing that should be obvious to everybody Rowley is pointing out, we're about to hear him, is that the number of police stations in London has been cut by 2/3 since 2010, since the Osborne cuts.
Yes, and of course we've got a police station down the road here in Easton at Trinity, which was built during the New Labour era as a kind of, you know, this is part of, you know, Labour trying to, you know, deal with the previous, you know, lack of support for communities like ours. And of course, it was built, state of the art police station. And then the Tories came to power and they said, well, we can't afford to put any police officers in it. Because, you know, we've got to balance the books, although there was no reason to try and balance the books in the middle of a global crisis. Because in actual fact, you shouldn't balance books in that situation. So the police station at Trinity was left empty for years. They couldn't sell it to anybody because you can't change it into anything. It's a police station. It's got no windows. You can't turn it into apartments of any kind. So eventually it's now been demolished. And they're now going to build luxury flats on where that police station used to be. So all the money that was spent on that police station, designing it, building it, putting it in place, totally wasted. And you wonder why they can't balance the books, because in actual fact, that was a false economy. And I'm sure what Rowley will be pointing out, that closing police stations in London was a false economy.
Well, I mean, also we can think about Ashton Gate as well, which is the police facility. The horses facility, that's all been closed. It's mothballed. It's just, and this is about four or five years ago, probably now. And the whole place is just covered with brambles now.
Well, that's right. I mean, the point is, austerity is the guilty party here. The idea that because the banks collapsed, we've got to cut all this public stuff, including police stations, including hospitals, including schools. We can't afford those things because we've got to bail the banks out and we have to balance the books. Now, we don't, in fact, have to balance the books. The Japanese haven't balanced the books for decades now and the sky hasn't fallen in. The US is a bit special case. They don't have to balance the books because they print the world's reserve currency. But we didn't have to balance the books either. And things like policing, if you have a whole generation of police stations closed and no recruitment into the police service, then of course things are going to go on the slide, because things like that have to be kept going. Otherwise, you lose the skills to make them work. And I'm sure this is the kind of thing that Rowley's going to be talking about.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I remember when I went into interview, I was very privileged to, in the Hong Kong Foreign Correspondents Club, when I was over there, what was it, probably 5 or 6 years ago, interviewing one of the journalists from the United States who was based in Hong Kong. And he was saying, well, there are quite a lot of Asian countries, including Singapore, that when they identify their political opponents, and if someone is starting to get a bit too powerful, then they just set the legal system on them and they drive them into debt. And by driving them into debt, they basically disable them. It seems almost to me as if the British government is targeting the entire population as their, unless there are people who are particularly cooperative and do as they're told, as the problem, and driving the population into debt, you know, to disable their ability to participate in politics.
Well, that's ongoing, isn't it? That's not necessarily directly connected to policing. I mean, obviously, the oligarchy carries on pulling the levers that it can pull to get the results it wants, whether you've got a Tory or a Labour government in this country. But the policing, you know, policing is the topic. And that's one of the areas in which this battle is played out, isn't it?
Yeah. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Mark Rowley. He's the Chief Constable of Metropolitan Police. I'll put the full version of his talk, which I think was recorded by Sky and nobody else, which is a bit worrying to think that such an important conversation can be, you know, sort of not really covered by hardly anybody else. But anyway, here's Mark Rowley now talking now. It's a little excerpt from his talk about the police stations.
The Chief Inspector of Constabulary said earlier this year, there are still too many police officers working in roles that could be better performed by police staff. The uplift target is now hindering efficiency and effectiveness, not helping it. The government should abolish this target and allow Chief Constable the freedom to establish the balanced workforce they need. Providing the right service to our communities needs an appropriate, sustainable funding model as well, and one that recognises the unique challenges of policing in our capital city. Over the past 10 years, the Met has been trying to police more people, with less money, in the most populous and fastest growing city in the UK, at a time when crime is more complex and more expensive to fight than ever before. Indeed, Sydney and New York have budgets per capita around 50% higher than London. We are working hard to reform, but are doing so in a context where our budget is heading off a cliff. Given the financial pressures of the past decade, commissioners and mayors have understandably pulled every lever possible to balance the books. We can no longer do that. We've relied on our reserves to a level which is no longer sustainable. This limits our ability to invest to deliver efficiencies. We're beholden to an annual process of funding allocation which provides no stability or ability to plan for the long term when an organisation is scaling up exit the net. Furthermore, since 2010, we've reduced the size of our estates from 620 to around 200 operational buildings in London. We did so to save 70 million to try and sustain officer numbers and raise over 1 billion. We cannot reduce that further. That source of funding has run its course. Indeed, most of our remaining estate is in a woeful state. We only have funding to refurbish our existing stations, believe it or not, every 120 years. If nothing else changes in the next decade or so, we expect to have to close up to half of our current buildings due to them no longer being habitable or legally compliant. Financial shortfalls have been passed from one year to the next and now landed in our lap, so that we're not only left with the damage to repair, but also a fifth-year budget for next year of hundreds of millions of deficit based on our current assumptions. And believe me, officers are as frustrated with the imperfections as the public are, but their commitment, and the commitment to thousands like them, is the reason I love policing. And they are the reason, I know that policing will, with some help, succeed.
So that's Met Chief Constable Mark Rowley speaking earlier this week in what was a very unpublicised Police Foundation speech. He apparently does one of those every year. But Martin, I don't know if you heard the figures there. He's saying we're now in the situation where we're going to, it looks like, have to cut our existing stations in half. So that's since 2010, going down from 620 police stations and facilities down to 100. So this is making sure, in a way, that the public don't really have access to the police. That and also, of course, the existing stations, a lot of them are not anymore in urban centres where it's easy, say, for example, near the shops, etc. They're out in the middle of nowhere. I know, for example, in Avon and Somerset, which is a separate force, it's Portishead, which is like sort of Sauron's Tower on the mountains nearby. It's not in the city centre anymore.
Well, that's right, because Avon and Somerset, of course, covers the whole of Avon and Somerset, not just Bristol. And, of course, that's probably less population than you've got in Greater London there.
Far less, yeah. So anyway, so that's, I mean, we're talking about bringing the number of police stations in London down from 620 to 100 now.
Well, that is, as I said earlier, this is the fruit of the austerity gospel. When the banks collapsed in 2008, there probably was no other option but to bail them out. But there was still no reason to dump the cost of that onto the public sector. It was the private sector, the banks, which had crashed the economy. It wasn't anything to do with overspending by governments. Nothing to do with that. And there was a perfectly obvious thing to do, which is to nationalise the banks and keep public spending up. In fact, because of the wobble to the economy and then the subsequent wobble from the pandemic, public spending has...
Could they not just have let the banks collapse?
Well, that's a possibility, and it could have been discussed. But, of course, it wasn't discussed. And if it had happened, and some on the right, like the von Mises Institute, suggested we should let the banks collapse, but they are a bit they're fantasists, because they believe that if the banks collapse, and that means everybody loses their savings, if you haven't got any savings, that's not much.
Well, that's not quite true, Martin. That's not quite true, is it? Because the government guarantees up to a certain amount of, is it £20,000 or something of the money. So the people that would have lost their money are those that have got more than 20 grand in a bank account, which is the rich. So it would have made quite a lot of sense to take the money off the rich, almost tax them by letting the banks collapse.
Yes, but the problem with that, I'm not saying it should have been discussed. It should have been openly discussed. It wasn't openly discussed, and you know what happened is they managed to blag the money off us, and we just paid it up. But the problem with just allowing the banks to collapse is you then have an uncontrollable social collapse, because businesses which banked with those banks will then collapse because they will lose their banking facilities and all the rest of it. And the knock-on effect, what the people who believe in letting the banks collapse, like the von Mises Institute, they believe that capitalism as a mechanism is infallible, and that what will happen is there'll be a period of chaos, but eventually capitalism will just come back, roaring back, and everybody...
Yeah, but my point is it would be the super rich that would lose most money, and actually small businesses wouldn't, and small individuals wouldn't so much.
Well, all right. I mean, if we're going to have a debate about whether it's what our friend Webster Tarkley would call liquidationism, which is you just let the crisis run through and you don't try to take any steps to try and deal with it. You just let it happen, because capitalism is such a wonderful system. It crashes once in a while and then it just magically reasserts itself.
And there's also the
businesses re-encharge the economy. The green shoots of recovery just automatically come.
Well, now, would they? They might not. But then the other thing is the reaction through the government could be simply to print money and to get the economy going that way. Both sides of this are potentially... But anyway, I think you're right. I mean, it's the sort of philosophy that comes from, oh dear, what a shame, the economy's crashing, and we don't have any money to spend on public services. That's why the police is in the state it is. Anyway, let's have a listen now to John Wedger, I spoke to earlier this week. He's a former detective in the Metropolitan Police that came out in around about 2005-2006. And I've got a longer interview with him, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But let's start with the little clip of him talking about what he thinks is King Charles's role in this, because he notes that the King was very, very good friends with people like Bishop Peter Ball of Gloucester, who was definitely a paedophile, and obviously Jimmy Savile too. So let's have a listen to John Wedger now.
Massively. And so one thing the public needs to understand is if we got a right-wing government, the judiciary, the attorney generals will be right-wing leaning. And when the left gets in, they get replaced with left-wing leaning. And that's how it's always been. So you would always have a political bias when a different side of politics gets in. And that's how it's always been. And ultimately, yeah, the Crown is there to hire and fire, but they will come under, you know, the representations of those lower down. So our whole judiciary would have changed the moment Starmer got in there. And of course, we saw that with what's happening with people going away for offences that a couple of years ago, even a couple of weeks ago, they would have got penalty charge notices for. Now, I said something to one of the whistleblowing cops, and I said, I don't think that the Crown has ever forgiven you for exposing what you did. And he exposed some people very high up in our political realm. And I said, if Charles, I refer to him as Sausage Fingers. I said, if Sausage Fingers gets in, I said, he's going to come for us lot. And straight away, we started seeing cases reopened on victims and survivors who made allegations. They went back and they started attacking the bravest police officer I've ever met, which is Mike Veal, who exposed Ted Heath, where people weren't going to believe what he was involved in, and now they do. He come under a renewed attack the moment Charles got in. That's not by accident. I think my opinion of Charles is a very, very damaged, nefarious individual indeed. And I think Queen Elizabeth, there a lot of people within the military and you know, her Crown servants on the civilian side, such as the police, did have a lot of respect for her. And I think they did. If I was... not that it would ever happen, but if she was ever to offer me the Queen's Police Medal or an MBE or an OBE, I would have willingly accepted it. But I would not have the same opinion by accepting anything that was given to me by Charles. I wouldn't. I've heard things myself, which I won't repeat here about him. And again, as the adage goes, not my king. And I would stand by that. He's not my king. And I think we're going to see... a lot of changes when it comes to the law, how big sexual offence cases such as Operation Conifer and Middleton and all the other ones involving organised and systemic child abuse. I don't think we will ever see anything of the like ever again under Charles. I don't think it will ever get to that. And I think he will deliberately underfund investigation units where child abuse is concerned. I genuinely believe he will fail the survivor community and the British public in general when it comes to child abuse investigations. I really do.
Yeah, and John went on to explain to me what he describes as really the gradual decline of British policing.
Well, let's break this down. I mean, let's start off with Mountbatten. The CIA just released their files on him, and they knew of his nefarious activities around young boys and the threat that he was to young boys. And they advised the British military that this man is not stable mind. He's got a paedophilic leaning, and he should not in any way be put in a place where he's a decision maker. And what did the British military do? They put him Admiral of the Fleet, where he had ultimate decision making, whereas he was warned not to. So they knew what he was doing. So you can't tell me our people didn't know what we're doing. But if we move then on to Bishop Bull, I mean, as a result of Bishop Bull, one young man killed himself. He was doing the most evil punishment to anyone under his pupillage. He was a typical paedophile. He was a deceiver. He would tell these young boys that came under his jurisdiction that they needed to suffer as of Lord Jesus Christ. And he would then say, we need to be in a place of redemption and humiliation. And what he was doing was whipping them, severely beating them, and then buggering them. And one young man killed himself. So in my opinion, he's a vicarious murderer. But not only Charles protect him for 16 years at his royal residence, you know, with all these allegations going on, Charles went on to denigrate the victims and call them liars. Call them liars once he was armed with all the information. This man should not be governing our country. He should not be in charge of our judicial system, our lawmakers, our policemen. He should not. This is a man who can't make the right decisions, and his influence is dirty. And same with Savile. I mean, come on. I mean, they all knew what he was doing. But all these files get locked away. They get locked away. And one day it will come out, and it'll be, but unfortunately, I think it'll be too late. But, you know, I don't really care what people's opinion of the police are. I think we went from having the safest capital city in the world. London was, and why was it? Because we had a police force that on the whole couldn't be corrupted. They were well paid, they were well maintained, they were well disciplined, and they were well present. They were every street corner had a copper on the beat. They got rid of that, and we have got one of the, well, it's an embarrassment, you know, to law and order, what we've got now. It's disgusting. There is no standards. It's just an absolute mess. And that, like the old adage, they couldn't make themselves shaving unless a crime is backed up upon allegation with audio and visual footage. They do F all. 80% of all reported crimes in the metropolis are instantly written off because they're not instantly provable. Well, that's the police's job to investigate. That's a detective's job to go on a fishing expedition, find the evidence, whether it goes towards or away from a suspect, and then go to work. That's what we pay them for. But they don't do that anymore because they can't do that anymore, and they're not allowed to do it anymore. It's a national disgrace, and they shut down police stations. Things evolve, Tony, right? Police stations evolve. They started off on the River Thames to police the boats from the East India Company, the Marine Police of London, which went on to become the most successful police force ever, right? And then it moved on to the Bow Street Runners. And these stations were placed, you know, in the epicentre of all our conurbations, whether they urban, rural, or semi-rural. They were there, right, where bus routes went, and everyone could pop in there and make an allegation 24 hours a day, no matter what the weather. They shut them all down. Police stations are on the periphery, the outskirts of our cities and urban areas now. A lot of them aren't even served by bus routes or transport connections. So how are the people meant to get there? And then you've got to go online. Well, what if you're old? What if there is no connectivity? What if you're ignorant to it? What if you're dyslexic? What if? That, you know, we had a perfect police force. It's a bit like our black cab drivers, the envy of the world, because there was a standard. There was a professionalism about them, a decency about them, something wholly British about them. And then they get Uber drivers and it's just a mess, you know.
That's wrong. What do you put this decline down to?
Well, it's deliberate. It's deliberate. It's been a steady, steady race to the bottom. Whether they want to erode us as British people, turn us into morons, well, they've done a good job of that. I work, and I'm not denigrating anyone. My heart goes out to a lot of these young lads that get caught up in crime, because a lot of them are survivors of shy domestic circumstances. Right. But so many of them are illiterate. They're inarticulate. You know, if the white middle classes of this country knew the state of our young citizens of inner city areas, they'd be horrified. You know, they're borderline moronic, some of them. They can't articulate. They're ignorant. I cannot believe the ignorance of them, you know. One of them the other day didn't even know not where it was. He asked me what was Glasgow. And I couldn't believe it. And I told him it was a city in Scotland. And then he asked me, were there polar bears walking around the streets there? A grown man, you know, and he wasn't even retarded. But that's what he came out with. And it's that they've been failed. It's just a deliberate failing. They've cost cut. I don't know what they've done. but that they've deliberately done it because no sane-minded, decent individual would allow this madness that we've got. And it is madness. We've got these young men in the morning are smoking skunk weed, cannabis of such high THC that they become paranoid. My friend, he's a long-term serving officer, probably one of the longest-serving murder squad detectives in the UK, senior officer when he retired, spent all his career investigating murders. He said 80% of the murders in London are committed by young men with cannabis psychosis. It's crazy madness out there. And anyone who tells me cannabis is all right, well, it might have been in the 70s and the 80s when they had very weak resin that they sat round and, I don't know, it's not my thing. But what they're smoking now is mind-blowing madness. And combine that with a young, developing mind, brain, and combine that with someone who comes from trauma anyway, you know, you've got yourself ticking time bombs. And we're seeing that with the stabbings and the murders.
If someone gave you Mark Rowley's job, could you turn it round? Is it possible?
No, because Mark Rowley, whatever people think of him, he actually came to my assistance. He was an assistant commissioner then, and he overrode Cressida Dick, who I think she's vile. I openly called her a liar in a court case because she did lie. I've got no respect for her, but Mark Rowley actually assisted me. But bear in mind, Mark Rowley, when he walked out of a parliamentary meeting the other day, the other week, the other month, and he grabbed, there's a shock horror, Mark Rowley through a microphone of a journalist, right? Just after the riots had kicked off, Mark Rowley gets summons to this meeting. He turns up at number 10, he goes in, he comes out, and he's a different man coming out as what he went on in. And he gets accosted by a journalist who puts a microphone up his nose, and Rowley just picks it and chucks it. And he picked it and chucked it, not because he's unprofessional, you know, not because he's an idiot, because he's a man who has just experienced the total and utter denigration of the last bit of decency of our police. I guarantee you now, when he was in that meeting, Starmer told him his future and the future of policing, and it went against every sinew of professionalism and high expectations that man had for his force. I reckon he's been dictated to that this is what we're going to be doing now to the public, and I reckon it appalled, disgusted and horrified Mark Rowley, and that's why he picked that mic up and chucked it.
So that's John Wedger again there. In fact, it's funny because at the time I said something similar. I thought Rowley had been into that meeting and was just really angry about the politicisation of his job. He's being told what to do by these politicians, which really, you know, the police should be independent of it. But anyway, Martin, he paints a pretty, I think, interesting picture there of this sort of slow collapse. And I mean, I feel similar in a way, having watched the mass media in Britain ever since the 1980s be slowly strangled until it's become very uncritical and almost like a kind of advertising, a mouthpiece for the establishment.
Well, I think if you're thinking what links all these different things together, it is in fact the neoliberal philosophy of private affluence, supposedly, and public squalor, which is what John Kenneth Galbraith called it in 1950s America. So we've become a society obsessed with individual consumption and getting ahead and making money, however, you know, not how you make it, as long as you make it, you're making it. And of course, those social bonds, which used to hold society together, like, you know, boring as it was, people used to go to work in the same factories their dads used to go to work in, or down the same mines or whatever. And we're now in an atomized society where private security, for example, is going to be running the policing in gated communities. It's much more similar to the United States. We're going to be more like the United States. That's the aspiration of the British ruling class. And of course, in the United States itself, they're going to be more like Latin America, more like Colombia, more like Mexico. And that is the direction capitalism is going in. And it's been going in that direction all my lifetime.
It has. Yes, yeah, so that the full interview with John, I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. But the final clip, I actually got to grips with a few other issues, including this proscribing of the far-right Order of the Nine Angles, because you know this is an organisation which is both satanic and Nazi, and it's actually organising in the UK. Interestingly enough, Yvette Cooper, when she was in opposition, called for it to be proscribed. It just seems amazing to me that some organisations such as Hamas or Hezbollah are proscribed under the Terrorism Act, but not the Order of the Nine Angles. So, along with some other things, let's have the final clip from John Wedger now.
As you're one of the few people who talks out about satanic ritual abuse and its reality, in the murder of children, the torture of children, and ritual abuse is also one of the biggest providers of snuff and child pornography, and it's a huge money-making revenue. Many Western countries realise that ritual abuse goes on and have special occultic crime units. The NYPD has one, Johannesburg's got one, and London being the most diverse capital city in the world, you know, an ex-colonial, so we've got people that come from source witchcraft countries, the Caribbean, they have Obia, Juju, Kendoko, Mooty Killings. I mean, I can go through a whole raft of it. You've also got a form of witchcraft from Romania, from Indonesia and everything else. And the Nine Angles is a satanic order. And it is occultic. And it's bizarre because it's paramilitary at the same time. And there have been quite a few high-profile followers. One of them was a guy called David Copeland, who was the nail bomber who went on to blow up a gay bar in Old Compton Street, the Admiral Duncan, and then he blew up, put a nail bomb in Brick Lane, which failed to go off, but he also put one in Electric Avenue in Brixton just to cause chaos, and he was a staunch follower. He wasn't, I think, a ratified man, but when in order to go in there, it's hugely hierarchical. And I say they warrant them according to their murders. But part of the initiation is that they have to undertake mental and physical tasks, which are almost akin to an elite military regiment. You know, one is to walk 30 miles with something like 35 kilos on your back in an incredibly short period of time, cycle 200 miles in 12 hours. I mean, it's just superhuman, but people do it. I think this guy called David Moyles is one of the main pushers of this thing. But it's alive and it's, well, and it does target the alt-right. It targets the right-leaning members. I think there was like Combat 18, and them sort of skinhead oi music movements. One of them was sort of had affiliations to the Order of Nine Angles. It's dangerous, and it is Satan worship, and they use a sort of a Crowley-esque type doctrine. And yeah, a very, very bizarre thing. I've done, you know, I have done research into it, and I'm aware of you know the member, the founder member in the UK. He was a monk for a while, and then he became, a staunch Catholic, and then he converted to Islam while still being a member of the Order of Nine Angles. Strange individual, but it is alive, it is well, and it does crop up with alarming regularity in some of the testimonies I received from victims and survivors of ritual abuse.
Yeah, so why is it not banned? Obviously, it should be you've got Hamas, which is the elected government of Gaza, is proscribed, but the Order of Nine Angles isn't.
Yeah, I know. It's alarming. It should be. And it just goes to show the lackluster approach and I suppose the deliberate ignorance, the cognitive dissonance of our cabinet ministers not to accept that this sort of occultic fanaticism goes on. And it's frightening, and it does go on. It really does go on. And like most things, it's occultic, it's covert, it's hidden. It's not going to smack you in the face, but it is there. And it has
I mean, the reason it doesn't smack you in the face, what amazes me is all the billions of pounds poured into the London press. There's hardly a mention of it ever. Anyway, look, John, if people are interested in following you, following your work, whereabouts do you most regularly pop up? Where can they find you?
I do a regular show with Sean Atwood on Sean Atwood show on a Tuesday. Do a crime theory on a Thursday night. I used to do quite regular little podcasts myself, but sounds a bit horrible, but I started dealing with a lot of people with profound mental health problems, and they ended up treating me like their unpaid counsellor. And when I didn't do what they wanted, they turned on me and all sorts. So I sort of withdrew from public life a little bit. But
it's the thing is, when you help people who are mentally ill, you will find yourself quite often at the brunt of their anger, which is mental ill.
It is, and that's the sad thing. It was projection. They would blame me, and then I'd be accused of working for the government, and all sorts of things. You know, that John Wedgwood works for MI5, and you know, so if only I did, I'd be gaining two pensions by now. But
I
do crop up. I'm on Facebook. I'm on TikTok. I pop up every now and then. Someone said, be like a submarine, you know, every now and then come up for a little while, then go back under. So I'm sort of hedgehogging at the moment. I'm keeping my head down, but I will be making a burst of public appearances in the very near future. And I'm in the process of writing a book, so I'll be bringing out an autobiography soon, all about police cover-ups, police corruption, and the extent that the police and the government will go to shut things up, in trying to do it in a non-conspiratorial way, because there are good police officers out there, there are good politicians out there. It's not all lost, but it's just very precarious, sort of heartbreaking times at the moment.
Okay, John Wedger, thanks very much for joining us.
God bless you. Thanks ever so much, Tony.
So there's John Wedger, bless him too, you know, doing some great work actually these days, talking to underprivileged youngsters and people who are just being caught up in the criminal gangs and that sort of thing. But what he's saying about Order of Nine Angles is particularly interesting. It's nice to hear. I mean, I just put that to him. He knows all about them. He's done his research back in 2020. During all the pandemic stuff, in March, Yvette Cooper came out, as the BBC reported, as against the Order of the Nine Angles, demanding that they be shut down. She says, as part of a Hope Not Hate campaign, Yvette Cooper, MP, who was chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee at the time, said the Home Secretary should immediately refer the Order of the Nine Angles to the government's proscription review group. The combination of Nazi Satanism, extreme violence and sexual abuse makes it particularly troubling, and action needs to be taken to prevent them grooming and radicalising other people. So that's Yvette Cooper in 2020. Scroll forward a little bit to 2022. You have this guy, Eric Meltzer, Martin, in the US Army, who was then discovered to be giving information to the Order of the Nine Angles about locations and the layouts of US Army bases, and he was given a 45-year jail sentence. So certainly the US Army takes this organisation seriously, even if the British Cabinet doesn't, or if Yvette Cooper has forgotten all about this, now she's Home Secretary.
Well, it's quite possible, Tony, that the Order of the Nine Angles is, in fact, it's plugged into NATO intelligence service networks, as Al-Qaeda was. Al-Qaeda was created by MI6. Everybody goes, oh, the big enemies, these jihadis. The mother and midwife of Al-Qaeda was Margaret Thatcher and the MI6. And of course, they've got the same interest in far right groups, because what they do when they're playing their games is they create plenty of enemies for people to hate. So they don't want the Order of the Nine Angles banned, because we can use them as a way to freak out the liberals. Look at these terrible people who hate Muslims and are going to attack mosques. And the same thing they can do with the middle of the road, middle class people. Look at all these terrible jihadis who are blowing things up. But behind all of that sits the deep state, as it was in Italy in the 1970s. And after decades of research into all of this, it's absolutely clear what's going on. And I tell you who does know about all of this: the Britain's enemies in Russia, because their intelligence services follow everything.
I think you might well be right. Yeah, I mean, they were also keeping a very close eye on the VIP pedophiles right the way through the Cold War, spying on them. In fact, apparently in Moscow, they've got a massive dossier on that, which at some point they may get out. The other thing about this Nine Angles, why is it Nine Angles? Well, what's going on here? If you think about the Star of David Israeli flag, that is six angles, isn't it? So if you imagine one triangle is three angles, another triangle on top of it is six angles, well, maybe another triangle on top of that is nine angles. So who knows whether this is in some way connected, but the fact of the matter is there seems to be complete and utter impunity as well for the Israeli genocide amongst the British establishment. That seems to be something that they're very happy to go along with. Just moving on to look at the character assassination of Mohammed Al-Fayed, would you characterise it as such today, Martin, this attempt to say that Mohammed Al-Fayed was a sexual abuser of his staff? Of course, everyone seems to have waited until after he's dead in order to do this. Mohammed Al-Fayed, of course, was quite wealthy, and he would have most definitely taken these people to court, leaving it until after he's dead. Many of these allegations go back to the 1990s, early 90s, mid 90s. They've left this for like 30 years until the guy's dead, and now it's all come out in public where he can't prosecute them, and of course he can't answer or explain any of these allegations now he's dead.
Well, I think the police have been approached and said, you know, Metropolitan Police presumably, and they've been approached and asked, you know, did you look into these allegations at the time? And I'm just about to sneeze there. And as I understand it, I haven't followed the story that closely, Tony, but as I understand it, this week the police said, well, we looked into these allegations at the time and we've decided that there wasn't enough evidence to proceed. So it's not that these allegations have come out now all these years later. They were made at the time, and the police took the decision at the time that there wasn't enough evidence to proceed. That's how I understand the story as it stands at the moment.
Obviously. That's right.
Yeah, it may, you know, it's no use presuming too much about this, because it really just does depend. Lots of powerful men, even, you know, they're easily got at because they've got plenty of foibles that are get-at-able, you know. Don't forget, the whole Epstein affair demonstrates, and the Jimmy Savile affair demonstrates, that in actual fact, the deep state goes out of its way to implicate everybody it comes into contact with in one way or another, especially with paedophilia is a perfect way to blackmail people, which is why they're encouraged to indulge in it so they can be blackmailed. And yeah, of course, I mean, if that's about the line, then we jump over your head. But if you do as we say, then we won't.
I was listening to the press conference earlier today about Mohammed Al-Fayed, saying that he's an abuser. In fact, a massive list of allegations, which if he was still alive would be an enormous great libel case, which he may well potentially win. But some of the allegations were very spurious. They've never been actually tested. They were just literally reeled out on the television and on the radio at the press conference without actually ever having been tested. But most importantly, I suppose, is this implication that the high degree of surveillance that he put his employees under was in itself abusive. Well, actually, you have to think about the context of all of this. He is at war in the 1990s with the British royal family and with the British intelligence services. So he had to be very careful about who he was employing. and to make sure they weren't simply spying on him. So this is one of the reasons why this surveillance was taking place. But anyway, look, rather than go on about Al-Fayed, and of course he's been attacked by Ian Hislop and Private Eye ever since Hislop took Private Eye over and got rid of Richard Ingrams and all the other people that started Private Eye. They took a very anti-Diana conspiracy point of view. They took a very anti-Mohammed Al-Fayed point of view right from the start in the 1990s and called him the phony pharaoh right the way through. Every time he came up with allegations about his son being assassinated along with Princess Diana, he was just rubbished by Private Eye. So I thought what we'd do is look at another character assassination. It seems obvious to me. This is rather like the rather shabby attempt to character assassinate Russell Brand recently. This is just another in a list of the same type of operation, a character assassination by the press. Well, actually, quite a lot of the press seem to be sort of a bit reluctant. But anyway, the fact is that these press conferences are taking place. Have a look now at the Michael Jackson case. So we're going to go over to Candice Owens, and she, I think, has done is an excellent, really rolling back of the character assassination of Michael Jackson. Now, I'm not particularly a Michael Jackson fan, although I love things like Thriller. We were brought up, but then we were told, this guy is actually a paedophile. I think Candice Owens has been particularly efficient and effective in completely turning that whole tale over and explaining how actually Michael Jackson was murdered for his back catalogue. And this whole idea of him being a paedophile was total nonsense. So I hope now we can scroll forward to have a listen to this specific piece all about Michael Jackson with Candice Owen.
2003 is when it began. It began when a boy named Gavin Arvizo accused Michael Jackson of child abuse, saying that he was under 14 at the time of the alleged crime. The singer was then charged because of this allegation with 7 counts of child sexual abuse and 2 counts of administering an intoxicating agent. What does the public actually remember from that time? What do you remember from that time? Well, we remember that Michael Jackson was Wacko Jacko, that he was crazy, that he was addicted to drugs, whatever his doctor was injecting him with. Here are just some of the headlines. Wacko, Jacko, Backo, Jacko, sex raid. Wacko, Jacko, Jacko on the attacko. I mean, this is like seared into my membrane. I'm sure it's seared into your memory as well. This is what I remember. And I also remember that he was anti-Semitic. Yeah, there were headlines calling him an anti-Semite, saying that he hated Jews. And by the way, they had evidence because, so weird, but his doctor who overdosed him also recorded Michael Jackson while he was also clearly sounding like he was high on drugs. Maybe his doctor gave him drugs and then spoke to him. And somehow this recording between this conversation between him and the doctor made its way out into the public. And yeah, it's a fact. In the conversation with his doctor, he referred to Jews as leeches, said that they were trying to take everything from him. And then he was labeled worldwide as, like I said, not just crazy, but also an anti-Semite. And that is just not what you want to be called in the press. It was then revealed that Michael Jackson kept an enemy list on which he had Tommy Mottola along with, I'm not kidding you guys, Rabbi Shmuley. Yes, that Rabbi Shmuley. He had him on this list. And Rabbi Shmuley, then after Michael Jackson died, then released recordings of him that he said Michael Jackson definitely wanted him to do, even though he was on this list for Michael Jackson. Also, illusionist Uri Geller, attorney Gloria Allred, the one that we associate with all the Me Too cases that have been taking down a lot of men. He also listed the DA, Tom Sneddon, and Janet Arvizo, the mother of that accuser, Gavin Arvizo. By the way, when you have spare time, you should look up Janet Arvizo. You should look up how many celebrities, I mean, I'm talking to everybody from Jay Leno to Chris Tucker, who have spoken out about that family and have accused them, many people, of intentionally being fraudulent. I'm just giving you the facts. You can look that up in your spare time. But this was his list. He had a list of Jews who he said were trying to ruin his life. But we don't really remember that part. We don't remember even that Michael Jackson, despite all of those media headlines and being accused of being a pedophile, he actually won his case. Yeah, despite 10 years of investigation, no proof was ever actually produced.
When you look into those allegations or those insults, you realize that because of his will that was probably fake and filed right before his death. So the will was signed on July 7th in Los Angeles by three witnesses. But Jackson's family pointed out that he was in New York that day and there's video proving it. So they changed their story, but the witnesses definitely saw it and it was just in New York. So anyways, because of this will, John Branca was put in charge of his estate, which included his net worth of $230 million, but far more importantly, his 50% share of Sony ATV worth $750 million. Yes, he was taking on Sony. He was going after the hand that feeds him. And when you look into John Branca, in 2003, Jackson fired Branca because he was siphoning money out of Jackson's accounts in collusion with Sony Music CEO Tommy Mottola and funneling it through a bunch of offshore accounts in the Caribbean. John Branca is Jewish, and Tommy Mottola is also Jewish. Plus, Tommy Mottola married Mariah Carey partway through his life when she was a young woman, and he was an old man. And there are other allegations about that whole situation you can look up on your own.
Yeah, so there you have it. Michael Jackson went to war with some very powerful people. And I don't know why, but I guess in his will, he wanted to leave everything to those very powerful people. It's interesting because what happened to Michael Jackson could never happen today, right? Back when all this was going on in the early 2000s, the media ran things. They completely controlled our minds. I, too, was warped to believe that Michael Jackson was a pedophile, and not that Michael Jackson had picked a fight with some very powerful people who have a leg in the media, who can make things appear and make things go away with the snap of their fingers. And since then, there have been a lot of artists who have tried to speak out about this type of mafia behavior, where if people don't get what they want, they will take everything from you and ruin you. To turn the king of pop, to leave him desolate and broke at the end of his career, is a crime. But, you know, here's the thing that I will say. They can lie, they can steal, they can deceive, but they can never create. Because these people do not have the creator force within them, because Michael Jackson was right when he said that these people are devilish. All they can ever do is try to dissuade the masses via lies and to go to sleep every night knowing that you are a liar, that you have no creative force within you, that you will always have to steal from people who actually do have talent. You will always have to lie about people who actually do have that creative force. That's a sad eventual ending for those individuals as well. And so Michael Jackson, they may have taken your money, they may have for a short term impacted your reputation, but there are so many of us in the world who now recognize the truth of what happened to you, and we have platforms and we have voices too, and we will continue to hold a candle for the king of pop. Happy birthday, Michael Jackson.
Yeah, it was Michael Jackson's birthday. That was Candace, I'm not sure if you can pronounce it, Candace Owens, who I was going to play a bit of something else from last week. We didn't quite have the time, but I did pop the interview up. She sort of seems to be a bit of a rising star. But at the end of the day, Martin, this whole business with Mohammed Al-Fayed, it's part of a pattern, isn't it? Really, everybody that's sympathetic to Diana or Dodie over the years seems to have been destroyed. We're talking also about individuals like the BBC's Martin Bashir, who did the interview in 1996, I think it was, for Panorama. He's been completely destroyed, at least his, and also the BBC has been instructed never to license any of that footage. So I would suggest that people all, you make sure you've got your own copy of the, whilst it's still available, of the 1996 Panorama Diana interview, and pop it up wherever you possibly can, since this is, basically the other side of the story in the assassination of Diana that is not allowed to be talked about with our present king. But anyway, what do you make about this whole concept of these character assassinations? I'm assuming they are character assassinations. What do you think?
Well, it's quite likely that they are. And of course, this stuff is actually this is the gristle, the meat of the way the system works, isn't it? As long as you toe the line and do what you're supposed to do, you'll be looked after. You will be compromised in various ways in which which you can be subsequently blackmailed. Lots of politicians have no doubt got lots of things in the cupboard which can be brought out if necessary. And we live in an oligarchy, a criminal oligarchy, very much involved in the drugs trade, for example. You know, the banks live on the drugs trade. There's what's just happened recently in Mexico is the Americans tricked two cartel leaders to come to Texas and then arrested them, which then destabilized the internal structure of the cartels in northern Mexico. And there's now been it's not been on the main news, but I was reading about it earlier. And it's now turned into a big, loads of people being killed on the street. People are trying to stay away from in their homes. It's not the same as what's going on in Gaza, but it's pretty gruesome. And the Mexican president, López Obrador, has said, well, this is the Americans' fault because they didn't consult with us before taking these cartel leaders, tricking them to come into Texas and then arresting them. And of course, the US government, especially if Trump comes to power, he's coming under very strong pressure from the right wing in the US. We've got to go into Mexico and sort it out. But the Mexican army is standing on the border saying you're not to do that. And the left have just won the elections in Mexico overwhelmingly. So all over the world, the way that the West does its business is definitely coming under scrutiny. And they've been doing it for years, as we know. I mean, this, you know, all of this stuff goes back a long way, long way. The relationship between the CIA and the mafia and the mafia and the banking system and the so-called formal oligarchy, things like King Charles and so on, it's all there because the internet allows people to research it in a way they couldn't before. But of course, it's all coming to a head because the system is now in a terminal crisis.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be. And the answer to the terminal crisis of these, you know, basically these oligarchs' chickens coming home to roost, their attempt to take power has been such a disaster that the only answer, it seems to me, that they've got is to bankrupt the population, if they possibly can, so that to shut them up and stop them from participating and having any kind of meaningful activity. But more importantly, in a way, supporting absolutely insane, ridiculous, appalling and genocidal foreign wars. So they're sort of almost painting themselves into a corner, Martin.
Well, they have, yeah. I mean, what astonishes me is the unreality of the discussion at the top in the West about how we're going to win. They're still talking about winning the war in the Ukraine. It's absurd, absolutely ridiculous. And how there's going to be a ceasefire in Gaza because the West is going to push for one, except that the Israelis have made it absolutely clear they're not interested in one. And the rest of the world, you know, the dogs in the street in townships in South Africa or Colombia or Brazil, they know what's going on because they've got cell phones too and they can access the internet. But the Western deep state puppets that run everything, they still live in, you know, they can't actually keep up with what's happening. The real problem is that they don't have a rational strategy, even from their own point of view, to resolve what's happened. They're just doubling down on what they've always done, and they've got enough power to destroy us all, but not enough power to win. They're not going to win, but then they could easily destroy us all.
It is a fascinating situation because it's almost as if the techniques which were used in almost like medieval times to bamboozle the population, they're still trying to use these techniques in the internet age.
Well, it's actually more sophisticated. I mean, in medieval times, a lot of social control was actually by your immediate people that you knew. You know, you actually knew who these people were who were oppressing your partner. You know, the king would be a long way away, but that wouldn't be what you would be dealing with. What we've got is the techniques of mass control were sort of developed in the 30s with the radio, and then television came along, and then the internet has turned out to be a double-edged sword for everybody. It allows us to criticize them, but it allows us to them to watch us, and it also allows, you know, look at the way they fought the war in the Ukraine. It's been one PR scam after another. You know, I mean, as soon as the Ukrainians invaded the Kursk salient, the Western media were cheering them on about how brilliant they were being, and there was no objective attempt at objectivity whatsoever. And I was reading earlier that the mercenaries in the invading force have actually been killing and raping Russian civilians, which of course everybody in Russia is watching on the TV, but we're not watching that. And there's a big gap now between what the Western public are being mainstream fed and what's actually happening in
the
world.
There is, isn't there? Maybe this is why RT was banned, eh?
Well, that's right. I mean, RT was banned outright in this country. So when organizations, you know, I used to be regular on their shows, banned outright. It's not actually banned outright in the US, as far as I can tell.
Well, no, in the UK, there are ways to watch it, but it's awkward. I mean, it's like there's ways to watch us, but it's awkward. So, I mean, the point here is it's a good time, I think, to raise the demise of TNT Radio, which was actually a TV program coming out of Australia. And that was a 24-hour rolling news with some really interesting presenters, such as Basil Valentine, who's a Brit, and Patrick Henningsen, they were, you know, actually part of a pretty professional team who were doing their best to challenge some of these Western rolling news programs. But they have basically just run out of cash. So today is their last day of broadcasting. Do you think is it feasible for anybody in the Western world to really take on these big controlled mass media, Martin? I mean, TNT have had a go, but they failed.
Well, that's an open question, isn't it? I mean, to some extent, we are allowed to do what we're doing now. But of course, then that's because it's not actually reaching an audience big enough for them to be worried about it. They are definitely trying to control what people see and hear. It's just trickier now than it used to be. But at the same time, they can still have it. You know, most people do not have the time, the inclination or the energy to look into these things the way we do on this show. If they use the internet, it's not usually for finding stuff out. You know, it's actually for entertainment. And therefore, the internet itself can become a part of, you know, people sitting on their phones as you sit on the bus. They're not checking on what's going on in the war in Ukraine, you know, and that's people. I mean, and the powers that be do rely on that. I mean, if people are busy aspiring to, you know, save up enough money to go on holiday, or worried about having cancer and whether they're going to be booted out of their house because they can't pay the rent, then obviously they haven't got much time to look into all this stuff. And that's the way the powers that be like it, isn't it?
It certainly is. Anyway, we're going to get on to one of your favourite topics, which is Ed Miliband. Well, I like to call him that, but I know you also like to defend him. Before we hear his speech this week about our wonderful new energy policy, which seems destined to destroy the country even further, let's have a listen to his speech back in 2015, when he was such a resounding, utter failure as Labour leader, and he had to resign from being the Labour leader because he'd just massively lost the 2015 general election.
In a couple of hours, I will no longer be leading this party. But you see, for me, that has never been the only way to achieve change. Because I believe it isn't simply leaders who achieve change. It is people that make change happen. I will never give up on that idea. I will never give up on that cause. I will never give up on fighting for the Britain I believe in. That faith will always be my faith. That fight will always be my fight. That cause will always be my cause. And I will always be there in that cause with all of you. Thank you very much.
Well, the genuine passion ringing out there from the lips of the Labour leader for the next couple of hours. He said only Ed Miliband announced that he is standing down after the election defeat as leader of that Labour Party, apologising to all the people he said who worked so hard for him that he did not succeed. Talked about the five hard years he'd had in opposition. Well, unfortunately for him and the Labour supporters, they face five more years in opposition, but not with him as leader.
Yeah, so that's from 2015, but of course he's bounced back. He's now because he's been hanging on as an MP, he's now in charge of Britain's entire energy strategy and energy policy. So this is his speech this week. Actually, funnily enough, both he and who's the energy secretary and David Lammy, who's now the foreign secretary, gave speeches about climate this week. In fact, Lammy saying that actually many of the wars, if we can sort these wars out, then we can also sort the climate out. So, you know, maybe there's some hope, but by jumping on the climate bandwagon, that some people will be persuaded to stop the wars, although I'm not entirely convinced by that. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Ed Miliband's speech earlier this week about climate change and about the British energy policy we're now adopting.
I'm determined we do not go from an unequal, unfair, high carbon Britain to an unequal, unfair, clean energy Britain. We must, in this transition, tackle fuel poverty, create good jobs, clean up our air, improve access to nature and quality of life, and I passionately believe we can. Our Warm Homes Plan We'll fund energy efficiency and clean heating to upgrade homes and cut fuel poverty. Great British Energy's local power plan will deliver the biggest expansion of support for community-owned energy in British history and ensure benefits flow directly to local communities, part of our commitment that where communities host clean energy infrastructure, they should benefit from it. And we will also stand up for bill payers by reforming Ofgem to make it a strong consumer champion. And this winter, we are committed, and I underline this, to working with suppliers and across government to help those who are vulnerable. And this role for government in guaranteeing fairness applies as much to workers. I know from my own constituency, a former mining community, that for decades the demand for good jobs has not sufficiently been met. We have the greatest opportunity in a generation to meet this demand, and I'm determined we will. Great British Energy will work with business to invest in frontier technologies to help us lead as a country. Our National Wealth Fund will strengthen our supply chains. The British Jobs Bonus will help reward those who invest in our industrial heartlands and coastal communities. And we are also determined to ensure a fair transition for every industry, including our North Sea communities. Our North Sea workers have huge talents, which can continue to serve us in oil and gas, as well as in industries like CCUS, renewables, and hydrogen. And we need your help to undertake this transition in the right way. Understanding your responsibility to build the supply chains for new industries in Britain, because we do care about where things are made. Embracing the voice of workers and a role for trade unions, as fossil fuel industries have traditionally done. And acting together with us to ensure no worker, no community is left behind.
No worker, no community is left behind. But at the same time, of course, Martin, he is one of those that's behind and has voted for this taking away of winter fuel payments from the elderly. He also uses this term, which really irritates me every time some idiot trots it off, which is clean energy, which includes nuclear energy, which, of course, is about as far away from clean as you could ever possibly get. So, what do you make of the attempt here to completely cut out all fossil fuels from our energy? Is it going to work? Is it a runner?
Well, I think the problem with it, it's hardly worth discussing because it ain't going to happen. The problem with the mainstream Labour Party, of which he is still a member and a member of the cabinet, is that they think that the economy, because it's a private sector economy, will just pick up automatically. Government doesn't really have to do much. Creating a new company called Great British Energy is not the same as renationalising the existing energy companies. British Petroleum used to belong to us. British Gas used to belong to us. British Nuclear Fuel still does belong to us because no private sector will, the private sector won't touch it. But the point about all of this stuff is it's pie in the sky because we're on the brink of a nuclear war which will kill everybody. And if we manage to stop that, we've then got the major problem of the banking system totally unreformed, ready to collapse again. And none of that is being addressed. We've got the soft left approach, which, they're trying to get green votes here by saying we're going to change everything for the better. Trust us. We're doing our best. Now, in a sense, Tony, you've got to realise that most middle-of-the-road, middle-minded people, they don't actually see the world in the extreme ways that you or I do. So what he's trying to do there is he's reaching out to the centre ground. He's saying we are going to have this transition to green energy, but there are going to be opportunities and we're not going to just throw people on the scrap heap, etc. But it's all just words. Because we're on the brink of World War III, and that's not being discussed. And of course, World War III is all about energy. The blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which was a massive methane leak, probably the biggest in history. As Greta Thunberg got anything to say about that? Well, she has a bit. She's 21 now. She was arrested in Denmark at a pro-Palestine demonstration. Now, if we don't stop World War III, there's not going to be an energy transition to anything.
Also, where is the money going to come from? He's talking about all sorts of, like, high, he's going to completely upgrade all of Britain's supply chains for all these new types of energy. He's also saying we're going to upgrade your home. Well, is there really any, are they really going to put any money into this? It doesn't seem as if they actually are. This is all just, like you say, just talk.
Well, that's right. And of course, the thing that they're saying is that when the British government sets up its new energy policy and its new energy company, all the rest of it, the private sector will rush in to invest. But that's just a presumption. The private sector, in fact, is totally fragile. The world private sector could just disappear. And I'm not just talking about nuclear war here. I'm talking about another banking collapse, which we've already been through. There could be another pandemic, because all sorts of things can happen. And it isn't just going to be a walk in the park where we gradually put solar panels up everywhere and we move into a different kind of reality. That's a fantasy, because in actual fact, the world is going to be changed. It's not facing the reality of what's going on in the world. And it's much sharper than he seems to think. But then he's not alone in thinking like that. That's what most people don't want to think about these tough things. They'd rather hear, you know, good time talking. That sounds more pleasant to people than confronting the fact that we're possibly on the brink of catastrophe here.
Yeah, and I think we should just stick to looking at the energy side. Obviously, if we've got nuclear power stations and there is, as you say, a world war or something, those nuclear power stations will be hit with missiles. They will be destroyed. They will become horrific sites of mass contamination. But there's no consideration about that, apparently, in the dash for nuclear. But the main problem, it seems to me, Martin, is that most of the rest of the world is laughing at people who are saying that you're going to have windmills and solar panels in order to run your energy system. They're not, the Chinese, for example, are having none of it.
Well, that's not true. The Chinese have got their eggs in lots of different baskets. They're world leaders in what you could call transition technology, electric
and coal.
Vehicles. Well, yeah, they've still got coal.
They're using all these what they call clean coal carbon capture techniques in China now.
In other words, the Chinese are taking approaches. We're not just going to do one thing here. We're not just going to get rid of coal because we can't. Let's face it, our whole model has been based on burning coal. We realise there's a problem with it. We've got to move on from coal and we've got to get more efficient. You see, they've been banned from selling their electric vehicles in the EU and in America, and they're going to put massive tariffs on them because they're more competitive. If we're going to move to a transition, then the Chinese have to be involved in that transition. The Russians have to be involved in it as well. But in actual fact, we're not talking to the Russians, and very soon we won't be talking to the Chinese, because that's not what the American multinationals want. They were the ones who were behind blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which has basically trashed the German economy and is now therefore going to trash the whole of the European economy for the benefit of US multinationals, including the gas industry. We are now buying gas from the Americans at three times the price we could have bought it from the Russians.
Yeah, you're right.
To the good, as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, so the big it's Ofgem, GEM, who are the big regulators in energy, and they seem to be absolutely, well, somewhere between absolutely useless and utterly corrupt. We've got one of the stories recently I came across is to do with, I think it's called the Biomass magazine. The UK energy regulator was investigating the Drax Group. This is the massive power station near Corby, we were hearing the other day, is gobbling up ancient woodlands, forests and trees at a rate which is chucking out carbon four times more than the coal-fired power stations used to do. But Drax Group, I see, will be paying the UK energy regulator, Ofgem, €25 million because the investigation has found the company misreported a whole load of data. But in order to not investigate it, the Drax Group have paid Ofgem €25 million. So they've said, well, look, rather than go into this, we'd much rather you just take €25 million and F off.
Well, all of this industrial infrastructure used to be owned by the government. It wasn't just regulated by the government, it was owned by the government, which gave the government the possibility to decide to do anything it wanted to do with it. We've got a neoliberal reality now, and the new Labour government, represented by Ed Miliband, as you call him, are not prepared to take on the vested interests behind that. They didn't stand in the election to take it on. They stood in the election to say, we will be a little bit better than the other lot, and that's all we're promising you. So that's, if people voted for that, they've got what they voted for.
Yeah, well, you're probably right. This also, looking at these kinds of the ways that these massive private equity monopolies just carry on and ignore these pathetic little useless regulators who seem to me like little ants being stamped on by elephants. Google has won its legal bid to overturn a €1.5 billion antitrust fine in the European digital advertisement case. So the EU has fined Google €1.5 billion. But you know what? Google has taken the European regulators to court and won. So no, we don't have to pay that anymore. I mean, this is just simply throwing money at lawyers to win the day in that case once more. Google, of course, being very much in bed with the deep state and surveillance, using its algorithms to skew elections, election fixing and this sort of thing. Anyone who's on Gmail who's listening to this, please, shame on you. You know, get away from Google. There are whole degrees of badness in the old internet world, but Google is just about as low as it gets. Also this week, this is interesting, Martin, in that it looks at what is supposedly going to be the way out for Britain's universities in developing new successful technologies for the future. Lord Mandelson this week has called for more focus on critical technologies as part of a wider industrial strategy. In key frontiers like quantum science and synthetic biology, UK institutes, of course, Mandelson being a major figure in the Labour Party still these days, UK institutions are producing less groundbreaking research than we would like, Mandelson told the Financial Times. Part of the solution is to accept that Britain is a mid-sized country. We are not the US and China. Right. Well, well done for figuring that one out. And we cannot be good at everything, he says. If we duck the hard choices about where to concentrate our resources, we will lose our edge, as if we had an edge anyway, Mandelson added. The new Labour administration has promised to kickstart the economy by investing in new technologies and the transition to net zero via a $7.3 billion national wealth fund as part of its five missions for government. So Mandelson's making his case, Martin, for a slice of that national wealth fund to concentrate on synthetic biology and quantum computing.
Well, I mean, what he's doing is he's saying, I mean, don't forget, in the decades of Tory government that we've had, there's no such thing as industrial policy. It's just so old-fashioned, Tony. You don't need an industrial policy. What you need is the market. Ask Liz Truss. Ask Kwasi Kwarteng. We don't need an industrial policy. So what we've got now with Mandelson, he's saying we do need one. It's just that it's not a realistic one. It's based on, as you said earlier, we've got to concentrate on what we're good at, but we're not good at anything anymore, so there's nothing to concentrate on. I mean, I'm not sure. This is a technical question. It's probably possible for the British government to invest in stuff which could be useful, but the question is what stuff? And that is definitely to be discussed. You know, you can't just presume you know. But on the other hand, having an idea that you ought to have some kind of strategy, well, you know, two cheers for democracy. You know, at least they've got that right. It's just a question of the one we've got is no good.
But synthetic biology, is this the future?
Well, synthetic biology is the future. That's where we're going, because we're talking about all of this, all of the things to do with algorithms and AI and, all the stuff they're talking about creating cyborgs and so on and so forth. So, in other words, he's pushing the World Economic Forum agenda, isn't he? And bidding for a place in it for Britain.
Well, it's nice that somebody is looking at the future of our universities. I don't know what you think it is, Martin, but the Telegraph this week was reporting universities in Britain are warning of financial disaster without huge fee rises. Higher student fees and taxpayer funding are needed to tackle a funding black hole in England's universities, a body representing the 141 institutions said this week. Universities UK said the government grants and fees have not kept pace with the rising costs, and they are unfortunately now relying far too much on foreign students, which is a number that they can't rely on it keeping going. The document is similar to the report published last week by Lord Darcy on how to fix the National Health Service. He's warning Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, that is, allegedly, doing nothing is not an option for universities as they're facing this massive crisis. They're demanding that tuition fees are raised in line with inflation as a necessary step. And in England, the tuition fees have been frozen at £9,250 since 2017, when they received a minor uplift of £250, their first increase since 2012. Universities have warned it means they're now losing thousands of pounds for every home student they enrol. So hence they are going for the foreign students, in fact, giving them places above the home students who the universities, Martin, are now seeing as a liability.
Well, I mean, we were talking about the police earlier, and then we moved on to talk about energy. Now we're talking about universities, and the problem is the same with all of it. The universities have become businesses. They used to be run by the government. Yeah, just like the energy industry, just like the police force before private, all the rest of it. And the sky is dark with chickens coming home to roost. And it's all very well identifying the problem, but now the resources have all been sucked into the black hole of the financial services industry. Those people are still getting their Christmas bonuses, you can be sure, even though they were responsible for the crisis in 2008 in the first place. And of course, the cutoff of cooperation with Russia, which would have allowed us to have a transition in Germany, for example, if they carried on having cheap Russian gas and oil, they could have actually developed a transition industry to produce electric cars. But now they can't, because they haven't got any gas and oil to make the transition. So we're actually in a corner now, but it's a predictable corner that we started to get into from 1980-81 onwards in Britain and the United States, and we've finally reached the end of the road. There is literally no more road to run, and the universities are going to go bankrupt. That's what's going to happen to them, Tony. I'll tell you now. They're going to close so that students in the middle of their courses, having taken out big loans to go and study, will be cast aside when these. And then, of course, the government may have to step in and bail out the universities, but as they'll have to bail out the care homes when they collapse. And of course, the National Health Trust hospitals, they will collapse. Don't forget, if we keep cutting everybody's benefits and wages, there's been they've paid out on the public sector pay stuff. That's one of the positive things they've done. But they still haven't balanced. They still haven't worked out what they're going to do. And of course, the real answer is to nationalise and to tax the wealthy, to close down tax havens and all this sort of stuff, is exactly the sort of policy that was put forward by Jeremy Corbyn in 2019.
Okay, well, just to wind up our look at the British economy, which is basically it's in its kind of free fall,
it's just flatlining at the moment.
Yeah, well, it's going down. I mean,
you can't flatline for long.
It's going down, isn't it? There are all sorts of desperate measures being taken to try and get money off people who've hardly got any money, some low hanging fruit, in order to prop things up. But they could, of course, just do this basic thing called the People's QE, which was floated under the Corbyn Labour when he was leader of the opposition. Anyway, look, there's a chap I've just come across, Martin, recently. He's called Gary Stevenson. I'm not sure if you've heard of him.
No.
He's a British, he calls himself an investor, but he's a sort of bit of a Jack the Lad from London, but he's extremely wealthy. And he did, I thought, very interesting interview, which we're going to hear now. It's called The Truth Behind Britain's Banking System. And he's talking really about the whole structure of the banking system and the economy, where the idea is that there are a tiny number of, as you call, oligarchs, people who have a massive amount of assets, and a tiny number of people who are constantly scrabbling around to get even a simple basic asset like a house or a car. So let's have a listen to Gary Stevenson now, The Truth Behind Britain's Banking System.
We have lived through, you know, the 7 years after the Second World War in the West, in Europe, in North America, were probably the best time and place to be a human, you know what I mean? And of lazy subconscious racism there, which is, look, you know, the Western world was really, really rich. Maybe we're just great, you know what I mean? But, you know, the reason the Western world was rich, in my opinion, was because it moved to a much more equal situation. And we're losing that now. But, you know, people live 70 years, they don't see the grand sweep of history. The truth of the matter is, you know, if you're a historian, you look back, that 70 years after the Second World War, that was the exception, you know. Most of history, including in Europe, including in the UK, is mass poverty, terrible living conditions for the masses. You know, a small elite living a very luxurious life, you know. That is most of history in the UK, in France, you know, in all of Europe. We can go, I don't want us to go back there. Mm. But people, and it doesn't bring me no joy to make these super pessimistic predictions, but people need to know that, because if they don't realise it, then it will come in without them doing anything about it.
Well, then let's talk specifically about housing for a little bit, because I was in the FT, I think this weekend actually, that in terms of the average house price versus average earnings, we're now up to about 8 times, right? Mm. The last time that was the case in Britain, 1876, right? So it's before the invention of the car, Queen Victoria on the throne. It's a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah.
For a start, could you talk about how inequality impacts on, I guess you'd call it home ownership, but perhaps it might be better to refer to it just as asset ownership, perhaps. Yeah.
So the simplest way to understand this is, if you give £1,000 to an average man or woman on the street, they will spend that, quite possibly that year, but almost definitely within the course of their lifetime. Most average people die with very little accumulated wealth, which means they spend everything they make, you know. My grandparents all owned their property and they died with basically nothing, you know. Ordinary people spend the fucking money they make in their lives. If you give £1,000 to, you know, they won't even fucking know this. It goes into the investment account and it accumulates, which means it's buying assets. So what that means is poor people buy goods and services. Ordinary people buy goods and services. Rich people buy assets. So in like a mass market economy, what you have is, you know, goods and services are expensive because people want them, which sounds bad, but what's your job? You provide goods and services. So that's good because you can get a good wage because you can sell stuff that are worth money, right? Mm. In an expensive economy, what is worth money? It's what the rich want. And what do the rich want? Assets. So if you go and look at, I think a lot of people in this country, they look at like these historical graphs of house prices as a multiple of earnings. And they say, oh, this is unsustainable, mate. Go and look at what it's like in really unequal places. Go to Hong Kong and see, you know. Mm. You know, go to Sao Paulo and see what the average wage buys you in terms of housing. You know, go back and look, you know, read your Charles Dickens, you know. Look at what the average person got for housing back then. You know, really unequal places have never provided good quality affordable housing, because at the end of the day, you are competing with very rich people to own those properties. And what the rich people want, I've got nothing against rich people. I am a rich person, right? Rich people buy assets and they hold assets and they accumulate assets and they naturally empire build, you know, because the money grows itself because of compounding interest, right? You know, you are in a competition with rich people for assets. If they are really, 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 really rich, then you can't. I think COVID shows that better than anything. You know, COVID was a massive accumulation of cash by rich people. People were predicting the house price collapse, you know. If you give rich people 800 billion quid, you know, house prices will go up. And I don't think we've seen anything like the last of that. I think house prices will go absolutely mental in the next few years in this country. Because, you know, the rich still have that money. They have a lot of money, you know, and you know, they either use that to buy houses directly or to mortgage lending, which indirectly, you know. Rich people buy assets. If you give all the money to the rich, asset prices will go up, you know.
Is it a simple question of supply and demand, that if we were to, you know, simplify the planning system, embark on this massive program of house building, not that I see that there's much political appetite to do that from either party, but nonetheless,
yeah,
boost the supply, would that do much to sort of equalize the market, you see, or bring the prices down?
So I still work in the city. It's a very international place. Then I went to study at Oxford, very international place. I studied at LSE, very international place. I speak to people a lot about what the economy is like, where they're from. Every single person in the world thinks there is a massive house price crisis caused specifically by the planning system in the city they live in. People in New York think this. People in London think this. People in San Francisco think this. People in LA think this. People in Tokyo think this. People in Shanghai think this. People in Sydney think this. People in Vancouver think this. People in Toronto think this. People in Rio de Janeiro think this, right? This is a global problem. And it's not even just, look at stock prices. Every asset in the world has gone through the roof. This is a problem about asset prices broadly, and it's clearly global. So, you know, we can fucking hang, draw, and quarter Sadiq Khan if we want. You know what I mean? And yeah, I've never met the guy. He might be a prick. I don't know. He might be lovely. You know, don't get mad, Sadiq Khan. I've never met you.
I'll cut it out, send it to him.
It's a global problem. It's a global problem. And it's, you know, I think we need to just be a little bit more broad-minded about things.
Well, go on then. So what, in terms of broad-minded solutions, how do you see, what is the way that we should address it then, if it's not the things that I just mentioned?
You know, I think you need to deal with these problems at the cause, you know. We've got to stop addressing, like, the million symptoms. You know what I mean? Okay, housing is unaffordable. The NHS is unaffordable. Wages are collapsing. You know what I mean? Holidays are unaffordable, you know. All of this, in my opinion, is caused by rapidly growing wealth inequality. Even regional inequality. I say one thing, one good example, right? Everybody, economists will tell you the reason London is expensive now is because people prefer big cities now. And it's true that a lot of big cities have become unaffordable, okay? So why is Oxford the second least affordable place in the country? Why is Verbier in the Swiss Alps gone through the roof? Why are the Hamptons expensive, you know? Why is Newcastle, which is a big city, why is Glasgow, which is a big city, why have they not become expensive? The reason is rich people don't live in Newcastle, but they do live in Oxford. You know, this is not about big city, small city. This is about if you give all the power, all the economic power to a tiny group of people, then everybody else needs to live where they live. Otherwise, how do you get a job? Mm. You know, if you have a good distribution, everyone is a worker, everyone is a consumer. So I can live with a group of people. We're all workers, we're all consumers. We all work for each other. We all consume off each other. If you give all the power to those guys, you know, they don't live in Newcastle, they never go to Newcastle, they don't study in Newcastle, then what do the people in Newcastle do for f***ing work? You know, I'll say it a million times, distribution matters, and I think, you know, you need to cure the cause. You know, if you keep trying to afford things you can't afford because you're poor, because all the wealth went to the rich, and you never do anything about the underlying, it's like we're playing chess, and I let you take my pieces one at a time, and then say, okay, well, how do I win? You need to deal with the structural problem. Mm. And this is why, you know, I'll say a million times, if you deal with inequality, you can make things better. If you don't deal with inequality, you'll make things worse. And people can point and call me a communist as much as they like, right? I make millions of pounds betting on this, all right? That doesn't sound very communist to me, all right? I'm not here because I'm a good person. I'm here because I'm a good economist, and I don't want this country I grew up in to go down the toilet. As simple as that, mate.
Well, apologies for the swearing there, which I hope in the podcast will be gone. But that's Gary Stevenson, Martin. It's something slightly bizarre about his... I mean, his analysis seems pretty good, but surely, from what he's saying, he is just a part of the problem. But he's salving his conscience, at least by talking about the problem he's created with this mass inequality and the speculative nature of, you know, the British... finance capitalism.
Well, as he says, it's not just British finance capitalism, it's global. And of course, Britain played a big role in forcing that vision on everybody else, because we don't just inflict it on ourselves, we inflict it on everybody that owes money to the City of London, and they have to do it as well. I think by and large, that is an absolutely excellent analysis. I mean, John Maynard Keynes, who went to Eton and Cambridge, would probably express it in rather different language. But then he's not a sort of East End boy like he is. But it's the same story. And as he points out, after the Second World War, that's what they call the l'état glorieux in France, the 30 glorious years, because trade unions were strong, because taxes on the wealthy were strong. In this country, the top rate of income tax was 95% in the 1950s, which is why we could afford to build lots of hospitals and new schools and police stations and all the things we've been talking about in this podcast. But of course, what happened was, as Kaletsky, who was another economist, a Polish-English economist at Oxford, pointed out, the problem with it is not that it doesn't work, it does work, but that the ruling class will eventually rebel against it. And if you look at Aristotle's Politics, he saw the main danger to democracy as coming from the oligarchy. The oligarchy resent democracy. And they because there's less of them and they've got resources, they get together to subvert it and get rid of it. And that's effectively what's happened. Britain and other countries around the world were successful in that period because the oligarchy was put in the box. The Second World War put them in the box. People who'd just been fighting and dying in their millions to change for freedom and all the rest of it weren't prepared to put up with the stuff they'd been put up with before. And they were also, used to bearing arms and knew how to use them. And the ruling class just had to give way.
Let's just say something about Gary Stevenson. He is from Ilford. He got a scholarship to the LSE somehow. Quite often those things happen because you have some sort of interesting, maybe a organised crime connection, who knows, but maybe it was just a genuine scholarship, just out of nowhere. No, this is before he became a trader. And then he became a financial trader at Citibank at the age of 21. Very quickly he became a millionaire just after 2008, within a couple of years. And he was betting that growing poverty would cause interest rates to stay low. By trading on this prediction, he claims to have become Citibank's most profitable trader globally in 2011. In 2014, he made so much money that he retired from financial trading to go to the University of Oxford. And he's got a YouTube channel called Gary's Economics. So he's done very, very well out of all of this, and at least he's speaking up about the problems with the inequality in the system. We're going to leave part one now. We're going to go to our musical break. We'll be back in a minute.
The first lesson is written in the 13th chapter of the Wisdom of Solomon, beginning at the 9th verse, in which the author laments our failure to connect the beauty of the created order with the power of the Creator. For all people who were ignorant of God were foolish by nature, and they were unable from the good things that are seen to know the one who exists, nor did they recognize the artisan while paying heed to his works. But they supposed that either fire or wind or swift air or the circle of the stars or turbulent water, or the luminaries of heaven with the gods that rule the world. If through delight in the beauty of these things, people assume them to be gods, let them know how much better than these is their Lord, for the author of beauty created them. And if people were amazed at their power and working, let them perceive from them how much more powerful is the one who formed them. For from the greatness and beauty of created things comes a corresponding perception of their creator. Yet these people are little to be blamed, for perhaps they go astray while seeking God and desiring to find him. For while they live among his works, they keep searching, and they trust in what they see, because the things that are seen are beautiful. Yet again, not even they are to be excused, for if they had the power to know so much that they could investigate the world, how did they fail to find sooner the Lord of these things? Here ends the first lesson.
hope has found. He is my light, my strength, my song. This cornerstone, this solid ground, firm through the fiercest drought and storm. What heights of love, what depths of peace, when fears are stilled, when striving ceases. My comforter, my all in all, here in the love of Christ I stand. In Christ alone, who took on flesh, fullness of God in helpless babe, this gift of love and righteousness, scorned by the ones he came to save. Till on that cross, as Jesus died, the wrath of God was satisfied. For every sin on him was laid, here in the death of Christ I live. Light of the world by darkness slain, then bursting forth in glorious day, up from the grave he rose again. And as he stands in victory, since curse has lost its grip on me, for I am his and
The second lesson is written in the 13th chapter of the Holy Gospel according to St. Mark, beginning at the first verse, in which Jesus exhorts his followers not to fear the coming trials, but to remain faithful to the preaching of the gospel to the end. As Jesus came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what large stones and what large buildings." Then Jesus asked him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." When he was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will this be, and what will be the sign that all these things are about to be accomplished?" Then Jesus began to say to them, "Beware that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name and say, 'I am he,' and they will lead many astray. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is still to come. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. This is but the beginning of the birth pangs. As for yourselves, beware, for they will hand you over to councils, and you will be beaten in synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings because of me, as a testimony to them. And the good news must first be proclaimed to all nations. When they bring you to trial and hand you over, do not worry beforehand about what you are to say, but say whatever is given you at that time. For it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death. And you will be hated by all because of my name. But the one who endures to the end will be saved." Here ends the second lesson.
Thank you. Let us pray. From the wisdom of Solomon. For if they had the power to know so much that they could investigate the world, how did they fail to find sooner the Lord of these things? Let us pray for a deeper knowledge of God through creation. Almighty and everlasting God, you made the universe with all its marvelous order, its atoms, worlds, and galaxies, and the infinite complexity of living creatures. Grant that, as we probe the mysteries of your creation, we may come to know you more truly and more surely fulfill our role in your eternal purpose. In the name of Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. From the Gospel of St. Mark. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. Let us pray for our world, for those places experiencing war and strife, for those who suffer at the hands of natural disaster, for those who will go this day without food and shelter. O God, you made us in your own image and redeemed us through Jesus your Son. Look with compassion on the whole human family. Take away the arrogance and hatred which infect our hearts. Break down the walls that separate us. Unite us in bonds of love. And work through our struggle and confusion to accomplish your purposes on earth. That in your good time, all creation may be renewed, and nations and races may serve you in harmony around your heavenly throne. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
That was we started out, didn't we, with a little bit of music from, in fact, most of that was little bits and bobs from a brilliant choral evensong on Radio 3 this week on Wednesday from Gloucester Cathedral Live, where it's interesting at the end there, he's talking about the wisdom of Solomon. Hey, hang on, guys. That is not in the Anglican canon. That's a book from the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church. Nice to hear it being read in an Anglican church. And I think partly because, you know, these things were squeezed out of the Bible by the Protestants. And the music to begin with was from Stephen MacLeod, or Steph MacLeod, he calls himself. And it's called In Christ Alone. And then we heard from Liverpool Express in 1975, that song, apparently a big favourite of Paul McCartney's, who knew the knows, I suppose, the Liverpool Express singers, You Are My Love. And so welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. In our second part, we'll be looking at some of the big issues around the world this week. Pager wars, and also, of course, the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, another one, not quite as serious as the last one, but certainly I feel in a way vindicated, because when I was doing my interview with Patrick Henningsen on TNT Radio just after the last assassination attempt on Donald Trump, I said, well, this may not be the last. And it's very nice of Patrick to get in touch, Tony. Look what's happening. Something, and of course, it may be that there is a deliberate attempt to. Somebody even suggested the Israelis have decided they want to get rid of him. So that's a possible. But anyway, really important that to cover this week is the UN General Assembly Gaza vote on Wednesday, which was controversial to some idiots because it talks about apartheid. Oh, you can't say that, it's anti-Semitic. And we'll be taking a good look at who voted which way on that, which gives us a great idea of what's going on around the world right now. But we'll start, Martin, with this incredible story about exploding pagers.
All right. Well, I mean, obviously, it's another twist in the cycle towards Armageddon, isn't it? The obvious thing to say is that they could have done this as part of an invasion of Lebanon, and probably that would have made more sense from a military point of view. But of course, it's also they can't really invade Lebanon. So this is
Well, maybe they don't intend to invade Lebanon.
Well, they say that they are.
Well, yeah, but they say a lot of things, don't they?
Well, the problem is that what's beginning to happen, which is that the military, the Israeli occupation forces, if we can call them that, the military are military, and they're turning around to the political leadership saying, we can't win in Gaza. Hamas are dug into their tunnels. We can't winkle them out. We can't invade Lebanon because we were wasted last time we did it in 2006, and they're much better organised now than they were then. So we can't win that. And it looks pretty clear that if we go to war with Iran, they will cause, you know, we won't win that. So, you know, there's some hope here. I mean, the Pentagon seems to be the people that are stopping Keir Starmer from firing British Storm Shadow missiles into Russia, because you've got to hope that the military professionals who know what's going on are saying, well, we can't do that. The problem is you've got politicians like Netanyahu, whose backs are against the wall, and people like Keir Starmer, who simply don't know what day of the week it is, who think they can second guess this stuff. And of course, the British military are gung-ho. They've been telling Starmer that they want to fire these missiles. Now, the problem...
Can we get back to the pagers?
This is a very, very sophisticated attack by Mossad.
It's okay, so look, I wouldn't say it's necessarily that sophisticated. What they've done is they've got a batch of these specific pagers manufactured by this company, Gold Apollo, over in Taiwan, although they say that the manufacturer, the Taiwanese say, no, these were actually manufactured on a contract for us by a Hungarian company. So I'm not sure who you believe, the Hungarians or the Taiwanese. But these pagers were a specific batch, a knockdown price apparently, but it looks as if they've had the, you know, these explosive capability actually stuck in them. I mean, I was quite appalled during the week listening to the British press coverage of this, because, of course, this is a terrorist attack. They were saying they're targeting Hezbollah, but, of course, they didn't just kill Hezbollah. They killed a load of children, and they've also killed a load of hospital workers and just random people who happened to be next to the pagers. Apparently, they buzzed, and then the idea is after a few seconds, they just blew up. The idea is whoever's nearby goes to pick up the pager, and then they get their head blown off.
Yeah, and then there's the double tap of the walkie-talkies, which were the fallback for the people who didn't have pagers. It's Mossad will be patting themselves on the back about this, and it's a way for the military in Israel to avoid going to war in Lebanon, possibly, because they can say, well, we've done our bit now to try and deal with Hezbollah, and that's all we can really do. It may be that they are preparing to attack. Obviously, Hezbollah will have to reorganize if that happens, but they can't win. And the problem from Netanyahu and the Israeli establishment is that means all of the settlements south of the Lebanese border are you know, that people are never going to go back there. And don't forget, they're not supposed to be there at all. The 1948 border didn't include that area.
Is there any precedent for this sort of attack? The idea of, you know, sort of personal devices. The only thing it reminds me of is a long, long time ago, the Chechen president Dudayev having a Hellfire missile actually targeting his mobile phone. So it was on his mobile phone signal.
It wasn't a mobile phone. They didn't exist in those days. It was a satellite phone on which he'd agreed to talk to Yeltsin. And then, of course, they were able to pinpoint him, and then they were able to kill him.
Well, mobile phones did exist in the early 1990s.
During that period, Tony. These kind of individual phone attacks, I mean, they've been carried out before, but on a smaller scale, you know. Booby trapped electronic equipment. Zakhachenko, who's the prime minister of Donetsk Republic, went to his local restaurant, and it was a bomb in a light fitting. In the hall.
It certainly sounds like something straight out of Q at MI6.
Well, it's basically nobody has actually achieved an attack like this on this scale. But of course, using electronic devices as a means of attacking people, well, that's been around for quite a while, but not on this scale. And obviously, you know, Hezbollah have got a lot of questions to answer about who decided to buy these particular, because it looks like they've been manufactured to order. Yeah. So in other words, Mossad have been working on this for a very long time. It must have taken years to get all the bits and bobs together to do this.
I think it's somewhere called the American Hospital in Lebanon. Apparently, all the staff there were told to replace their pagers about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Well, that may well be that we can start, you know, this, if we were John Wedger and we were carrying out a police investigation, these are all the way things you'd start to say, well, who knew in advance? Because that then suggests that they are potentially complicit with those who carried out the attack and so on. But, I mean, it's pretty clear that Mossad are behind it, even though the Israelis are keeping shtum, and the whole world is presuming that they've done this. And, of course, what the Russians have said and various other people have said, well, they just, you know, this is provocative. We're trying, you know, in theory, we're trying to get a ceasefire in Gaza and we're trying to prevent an escalation in Lebanon. But of course, if the Israelis go around assassinating Hania, assassinating, the Fahoud, who is the head of the Hezbollah, and then kill all these Hezbollah people and their families, that doesn't suggest to me that they're looking for a negotiated solution, does it? And that means we're not going to get a negotiated solution. Somebody should tell Ed Miliband there's going to be no negotiated solution here. And, you know, all the prayers that we heard in the interval there, maybe there isn't going to be Jesus coming to save us. It's going to be a war, Tony.
Well, yes, it's the same thing, actually, Martin. The return of Christ is in a war-type situation, in fact. That's the way it's prophesied, if you really want to get into that. But I'd rather you didn't, tread around in that area, because you tend to sort of stamp your feet a little bit too hard because you're not a believer. But anyway, this... this press TV have put out some interesting information about these remarks. They say that the company Gold Apollo said the pagers had been made by a Hungarian firm the company had authorised its brand to be used on the devices. But they have been absolutely clear in Iran. They're saying, well, this actually really, it hasn't killed that many people. It's injured quite a few. But what it really is doing is it's showing the absolute disgusting behaviour of the Western powers, and the ultimate effect of this attack is just going to be to turn the world against Israel.
Yes, I was looking at The Guardian earlier, and they've called it a daring and audacious attack. That's not the sort of language they used about October the 7th, was it? It was a heinous, genocidal attack where babies were beheaded, except they weren't. But this is audacious. Audacious, Tony. Very audacious. And when
that's the term the BBC used for the attack of Hanin, the chief negotiator of Hamas, to try and release the hostages and to broker a ceasefire. Iran's president Masoud Pezeshkian, I'm not sure if I pronounce that right, P-E-Z-E-S-H-K-I-A-N, almost unpronounceable, but anyway, he says Israel's pager detonations are a shame for the regime's Western backers, not least is the United States. He says the Western supporters of Israel feel unbound to any principle in pursuing their inhumane agenda. Speaking at a cabinet meeting in Tehran on Wednesday, he said the September the 17th pager explosions are more proof of the fall of humanity in the West. They don't want a ceasefire in Gaza. He said, using tools made to enhance the welfare of humans as a means of terror, death and destruction against those whose views do not align with us is proof of the fall of humanity and the dominance of savagery and criminality in the West, he says.
Well, he's not wrong about that, is he? I mean, that's clearly what's going on here. And of course, the other thing that's happened, as Scott Risser has pointed out, is lots of Western tech companies are going to lose a lot of money now because people aren't going to buy from them if they don't think it's secure. Loads of people in Lebanon, you know, threw their phones and Wi-Fi and all sorts of stuff away. So we've crossed the Rubicon here. where it's no longer Ed Snowden in Russia, who was whistleblower of the NSA spying. He was saying that, you know, this is what this is going to do is undermine the business plans of lots of Western high.
Yeah, but the Israelis don't care about that, do they? What they want to do is they want a morale blow.
That's
against
right.
Lebanon. They've also, Israeli airstrikes last night have been targeting Beirut. The death toll has risen to 12. Nasrallah and the Hezbollah are saying that these are deliberate acts of war against Lebanon by Israel. So they're not satisfied with just wiping out the Gaza population and uprooting them in a massive genocide. They're now, it seems, hell-bent on trying to provoke a war with Lebanon.
Well, don't forget that they were behind, and the Brits and the Americans behind, all the mayhem and bloodshed in Syria over the last 10 years, which kind of dropped off our TV screens ages ago. The Israelis are a menace to everybody in the region, and we are their accomplices and the people that are allowing them to do all of this.
Yeah, we definitely are accomplices.
The Lebanese foreign minister, who's not from Hezbollah, because it's a very tricky political situation there, he said this is an attack on Lebanon, and the people of Lebanon are united in refusing to be bullied by the Israelis. And in other words, what they've done, in fact, the Israelis, instead of scaring the Lebanese people, the Lebanese don't want to fight, the Iranians don't want to fight, and the Russians really don't want to fight. But when it comes down to it, if you do stuff like this, you force people into a position where they've just got to bite the bullet and fight. And that's where we are.
I mean, surely the Israelis are never going to do this. Although the Hezbollah are saying, come on, come into Lebanon, invade Lebanon, they're not going to do this. They're just going to try these various tricksy methods to kill people who they think, you know, even if it's kids, they don't really care, in order to try and provoke. So anyway, let's have a listen now. In our international section, there's a section here. Actually, Owen Jones did, I thought, an excellent report this week. I have my doubts about him generally, as a sort of piggybacker on various conflicts, who's not entirely to be trusted. But he did a really good report this week, Owen Jones did, about the media over in Israel, which is talking about erasing all Palestinians. A popular Israeli podcasters this week claiming that the most share their views, and they're actually just basically mimicking and mocking the Lebanese for being killed by these pages. So let's have a listen to that now.
Mm-hmm. No one actually gives a zero people in Israel. If you go up to them, are you like, do you care if this baby in Gaza gets polio? They'll be like, I don't just
care. Yeah, Dave Oppenheimer would care.
Yeah, okay. There'll be like 20 people who care, and they're all wearing Meretz shirts. Like, them. But seriously, nobody would give a They'd be like, leave me alone, man. I'm trying to, like, buy
eat
shit
ice cream
for Shabbat. Like,
yeah.
Off. I don't care about this Gaza polio.
Also, as long as they're in their Nakba state in their tents, you know, and we're living still, like, you know, if you put aside the news, day to day is okay. Yesterday we went to a concert.
Yeah.
In Ilkon Park. We had lots of fun, me and my girlfriend. Shalom Chanoch.
Wow.
We danced.
Yeah.
And it was amazing, and you can't help but think, like, it's nice to know that you're dancing in a concert while hundreds of thousands of Gazans are, you know,
homeless,
like sitting in a tent and eating.
Makes it even better,
yeah,
more enjoyable concert. If only they put the
live video
footage of Gaza. Like, but seriously, you guys, like, that's what people don't understand. Look, like, I know that you guys might be appalled by this, some of the listeners, but seriously, this is how Israelis feel. And you might think that Eitan Weinstein and Naor, who, like, refuses to kind of back me up on it publicly.
I'm from the UN.
Yeah, he's the UN. But you might think I'm extreme. But I have conversations with lots of people, coworkers, friends. People enjoy knowing that they are suffering.
Mocking the victims of the genocide. Martin, this is a endemic hatred and racism here. And so what do you make of this? Because this is something which is very deeply embedded. We've heard about the Chabad Lubavitch and these ways that young Israelis are brought up to hate Palestinians. And then they're gloating there over the genocide. They're gloating also over the idea that these pages have killed people who are not of the same race as them.
Well, I mean, obviously, I've been reading and following this quite closely. Those boys are actually quite popular in Israel, and they've actually worked for Netanyahu directly. So they are representative of opinion, as they boast. They boast that they're representative of opinion. They are representative of opinion. Now, ultimately, if a whole society, and it's not a huge society, there's a few million Israelis, but there's not masses and masses of them, a lot less than there are in Britain, for example. If a whole society becomes like that, then it behoves the rest of the world to do something about it, just like we had to do about Germany in the 1940s. If they're not going to reform themselves, and they're not, they're going to have to be dealt with, aren't they?
Well, they are. And, of course, the United Nations has been at least attempting to make some moves in that direction. What do you make of this vote this week, Martin? I mean, the vote on Wednesday at the UN General Assembly in New York was 124 for the ceasefire, 14 against the ceasefire, with quite a lot of abstentions in the middle. But even if you include the abstentions with against, there's still a two-thirds majority in the United Nations, over two-thirds majority, in favour of condemning Israel as an apartheid racist state and demanding a ceasefire. Of course, this isn't really translating its way through to the UN Security Council. This vote took place on the 18th of September this year. That's on Wednesday. Just looking at some of the countries, and maybe you could just give us your thoughts after, Martin, the ones that abstained... the ones that voted against, I think it's worth having a good old look at them. Argentina, which is now run by this anarcho-capitalist. They've also got somewhere called Czechia, which I think is the new name for Czech Republic. Fiji, Hungary, interestingly. Israel, obviously, they're voting against the ceasefire and the condemnation of Israel. Malawi, Micronesia, Nauru, Palau, wherever that is, Papua New Guinea, Paraguay, Tonga, the United States and Tuvalu. So those were the ones who actually voted against it. That's interesting, isn't it, that you've got quite a good, it's getting a smaller and smaller group with Israel and the United States in the middle of it, with a few countries like Argentina, Hungary, Paraguay. It's not a great part of the world which is against the ceasefire and against the condemnation of Israel, really, is it?
As I understood it, Tony, it's not just about for a ceasefire. It's to recognise the state of Israel, state of Palestine. Sorry, yeah. And that, so it's quite.
Yeah, that's also part of the resolution because Palestinians are not there in the General Assembly to vote on this.
They have been recognised as a state now. By international law, which means, of course, that the international law applies, whereas the Israelis were arguing that because they've not got a state, it's all Israel and therefore our internal business.
So are you saying that maybe in these general assembly votes in the future, Palestinians might be able to vote in these?
Well, that's the implication. And, of course, it's because the International Court of Justice has condemned the occupation of Palestine. And therefore, all of these countries, most countries in the world, have gone along with what the International Court of Justice said. As you say, some countries have voted in favour against this resolution. You gave a list of them earlier. Well, that's basically the Israelis, the Americans and their vassals, really. Their mates, these tiny countries who are basically dependent on the US and they just have to do as they're told. What's very interesting to me is that voting in favour of the resolution of recognising what we just said were France, Norway, Ireland, Portugal, and Spain. Now, these are neighbouring countries to us, and they can't see any problem. This, we're all on the west end of the European continent, and they can't see any problem with recognising a Palestinian state, condemning the Israelis, and ultimately, of course, the implication is that the EU should put sanctions on Israel. So Britain abstained. And there's another problem coming up for Keir Starmer, which is that the International Criminal Court wants Britain to sign an arrest warrant for Netanyahu. They're going to send it over and expect us to sign up for it. This is going to put Starmer in a position because he wants to stay in with the Americans and the Israelis, so he doesn't dare to sign it. But on the other hand, if he doesn't sign it, he's basically, you know, Britain is being seen to be basically not sitting on the fence. We're seen to be essentially not to be trusted by other
well,
forces.
Well, no, look, in our international section of, we're going to go to another clip now. There is, we're going to have a listen now to the one of the final speeches just before the United Nations General Assembly ceasefire vote on Wednesday. I mean, I didn't see enough, anywhere near enough real press coverage of this. It's megally important, of course, for the future of humanity. And of course, to get it, to actually force an end to this massive massacre in Gaza and the potential of the explosion of a third world war, which the United States and the Israelis and possibly even the Brits as well seem to want to do. So let's have a listen now to Bahrain, because they were one of the last people to, one of the last countries to speak at the United Nations General Assembly ceasefire vote on Wednesday.
I now give the floor to the distinguished representatives of Bahrain.
Mr. President, at the outset, I congratulate you on assuming the presidency of the 79th session of the General Assembly of the United Nations, and we thank you for resuming the work of the 10th Emergency Special Session to follow up on the advisory opinion of the ICJ on the legal consequences arising from Israel's policies and practices in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, based on the request from the General Assembly. My country aligns itself with the statements delivered by the Syrian Arab Republic on behalf of the Arab Group, Cameroon on behalf of the OIC, and Uganda on behalf of the non-aligned movement. Mr. President, Bahrain welcomed the advisory opinion of the ICJ, and we participated in, and we have co-sponsored the draft resolution that we will vote on soon. Given how important this draft resolution is to make sure that the rights of the Palestinian people are respected, that they can establish their own independent state with East Jerusalem as its capital according to the resolutions of international legitimacy. As the war continues against the Gaza Strip, it has been over a year almost. The Kingdom of Bahrain calls on the international community to carry out its responsibility to reach a ceasefire to protect civilians and to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian assistance to the residents of the Strip. The Kingdom of Bahrain also reaffirms what was mentioned by the Arab Summit that was held in Bahrain last May, and it was chaired by His Majesty the King of Bahrain, and we adopted the initiative for an international conference held under the auspices of the United Nations to settle the Palestinian question, to end the occupation of Israel of all occupied Arab territories, and to establish a Palestinian state that is independent and viable. In conclusion, the Kingdom of Bahrain would like to reaffirm its position of supporting all international efforts to give precedence to dialogue to end the war in Gaza, and we call on the international community to shoulder its responsibility to support the rights of the Palestinian people and to support the efforts to reach a lasting and just peace, to strengthen security and stability in the region for the benefit of all the nations in the region. I thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the distinguished representative of Bahrain. The result of the vote is as follows. In favor, 124. Against, 14. Abstentions, 43. Draft resolution A/ES10/L31/revision 1 is adopted.
Well, that's quite a victory at the United Nations this week. Interestingly, Martin, the Bahrainis are actually voted for that. It seems like maybe these Gulf states have had enough of their little love affair with the United States and the West.
Well, yes, it is significant because Bahrain, of course, is a dictatorship by the Al Khalifa family who were put in power by the British when they Bahrain used to be a British colony till 1971. And when we left, we handed the country over to the local tyrants, the Al Khalifa family, who are Sunni, although the majority of the population in Bahrain are Shia. And of course, during the Arab Spring, they rose up against the Al Khalifa family and were brutally repressed because the Saudi army came in to Bahrain and, were bulldozing Shia mosques and so on. So even the whole Abraham Accords, which were pushed by Trump and also by Biden, which was the whole idea was that the Saudis would formally recognize Israel, and then they would get together to try and create a sort of pro-Western, Marshall Plan for the region, where the Saudis would provide the money, and the Palestinians will be happy because they get jobs in the situation. It's just a fantasy world. But of course, what the Israelis have done is even their allies like Saudi Arabia do not dare to support them after what they've done. The Al Khalifa family in Bahrain and the Al Saud family in Saudi Arabia are not democratic, but they fear the populations of their countries, and they fear the potential for overthrow of their own regimes. And that
so really the Western Israeli domination of the Middle East is kind of running out of road.
Well, that's right. And basically, the Western domination of the world system is running out of road. This is the end of a 500-year cycle where people from the West went out in their little ships and then their bigger gunboats to take over the world, and they took it over. And now the rest of the world is biting back. But, of course, the Israelis are the fly in the ointment because they're a kind of, they're not a rational state. There's no you're reaching the point where there's no rational discussion to be had with them. They've just got to be militarily defeated. And I'm afraid that's where we're at in the world affairs at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, apparently there will be no Gaza ceasefire before the end of Biden's term. That's what the Americans are saying.
Well, that's because the Israelis are determined not to have one. There wouldn't be. What Hezbollah have said in Lebanon is, if you have a ceasefire in Gaza, we will call the war off. That's what we're fighting for. We're all on the same side here. Don't forget, the Israelis took over that region, and it was the British who said Lebanon's over here, Israel's over here, Syria's over there. These borders are artificial borders, like the borders in Africa. So in actual fact, there's plenty of people who say, well, in actual fact, that used to be ours and you took it off us. And of course, there was a potential for a two-state solution. The Bahraini delegate was talking about a two-state solution there. So are the Russians and the Chinese. That's where the mainstream of non-Western opinion is. But I'm afraid it's no longer possible for a two-state solution to function. People like Andrew Neil were saying, well, that, you know, if you heard him a few months ago saying, well, there's no two-state solution possible, so we'll just have to genocide the Palestinians. But in fact, there's no two-state solution possible. I'm afraid those boys that we heard earlier, they weren't even born in Israel. One of them was saying they can go back where they came from, because if they don't, they're going to die.
Well, it's certainly not the indigenous population. So let's move on to look at Ukraine now. And particularly over the last few weeks, there's been a kind of disappearance of this whole business of what's been going on in Kursk with the Ukrainian movement into Kursk. But this week, Eva Bartlett has done, I think, an interesting interview with someone I'd not come across before, Jacques Bold. He's a Swiss former intelligence officer. And he's done, I think, what I think is an excellent interview about explaining some of the roots of the Ukrainian conflict. So rather than look at what's happening there on the ground, because a lot of it seems to have been sort of puffed up propaganda that's gone nowhere about how wonderful the Ukrainians are and how they're going to win, all that sort of boring nonsense. Let's have a listen to him talking about the events in Crimea, because back in 2014, a lot was going on down in Crimea, and Eva Bartlett asked him about this, and he explained a lot of the history of the Crimea region and how even after it had been turned over to Ukraine, the Crimeans said, no, we're not having any of that, and they went off on their own. But then they were forced back by the Ukrainians to be part of Ukraine. So let's have a listen to Jacques Bowen now talking to Eva Bartlett about Crimea and what was going on back in February 2014 at the time of the Maidan coup.
Within the Ukrainian army, you had both Ukrainian speakers and Russian speakers. And what happened, especially in Crimea, when the army was ordered to shoot or to fight against the demonstrators, those who were Russian speakers just defected. Mm-hmm. They just changed side. And they removed their insignias and they just went to support the protesters. And they became, in fact, the famous little green men that we have mentioned about Crimea. These were not people coming from Russia, because there was no indication, and I remember I was NATO at that time, there was absolutely not the slightest indication that Russia brought new troops into Crimea. They were already based on the status of force agreement signed between Russia and Ukraine. You had up to 25,000 Russian troops stationed in the Crimean Peninsula. At that time, there were not even 25,000, there were 22,000. And you had a similar number of Ukrainian soldiers stationed in the peninsula. When the uprising started, just on the day after the 23rd February 2014, when the decision was made to abolish the law about the language, the Russian soldiers were allowed, according to the status of force agreement, to get out of their garrison in order to maintain the security of their garrison, including the security of the airport, because the airport in Simferopol and Sevastopol were, in fact, the lifeline for the Russian forces in case of troubles. And that was absolutely defined in the status of force agreement. And that's exactly what the Russian forces did. Now, the Ukrainian forces, as I said, and that's not my invention, that was said by a Ukrainian lawmaker at the Ukrainian TV, by the way, he said that out of the 20,000 Ukrainian soldiers that were deployed in Crimea, 20,000 defected to the Russian speaking, meaning that you had in Crimea, you had the 22,000 Russian soldiers plus 20,000 Ukrainian Russian speaking soldiers. And all that were in fact confused in the West, and probably deliberately, because everything I said is not a secret that was said in the Ukrainian media. That was confused deliberately in order to say that the Russians came into Crimea with special forces and whatever in order to take over and annex Crimea. Now, the interesting thing about Crimea is that what people also omit to mention is that you remember that Ukraine became independent in early December, in the 8th of December 1991. But what we don't mention is that in January 1991, Crimea got separated from Ukraine. And in fact, as you know, in 1954 exactly, Khrushchev gave Crimea to the Ukraine. But in January 1991, the people of Crimea asked to regain their autonomy. And they performed a referendum that was the first referendum in the Soviet Union, the first autonomy referendum in the Soviet Union, on the 20th January 1991. And based on this referendum, Crimea was detached from Ukraine and was no longer subordinated to Kiev, but to Moscow. And Crimea became, at that point, the autonomous socialist republic, socialist republic of Crimea. It was an autonomous republic, a socialist republic. And that's the status it had in 1945, in fact. That was exactly the same status. So detached from Ukraine. But when Ukraine became independent in December 1991, Ukraine wanted to regain sovereignty over Crimea. And you had a struggle, or literally a tug of war, between Crimea and Kiev. When Kiev established its own constitution and the Declaration of Independence in 1992, but Ukraine refused that. And in 1995, Ukraine toppled the president of Crimea forcefully with special forces and annexed forcefully Crimea. So Crimea had a very special situation in the whole situation in 2014. And since this situation arose, and with all the troubles and all that, the people of Crimea decided to remake the referendum that it used to make almost 14 years, 25 years before, and to ask for autonomy and then to join the Russian Federation. That's exactly what happened.
So that's Jacques Baud there. Martin, I mean, this is an interesting history, isn't it? Crimea has clearly been a sort of tug of war amongst the oligarchs of the world, saying, well, no, Crimea, it's essential to keep that as part of Ukraine, because then in a future conflict, we can say it's part of Ukraine.
Well, that's right. And of course, most people in the West do not know this history. They're not taught it. They don't, you know, at the time, It was totally obfuscated. Crimea historically had never been part of Ukraine, and Ukraine had never been an independent state. It was essentially an internal part of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. It was the Union, the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, and the borders of the Ukraine were decided in the first place by Lenin. And what he did is, because of his own policy, he was suspicious of Russian nationalism. So he gave the Ukrainians, a separate socialist republic. But he made it a mixture so that the Ukrainians got their own republic, but they had to take in loads of Russian people as well, which didn't make a lot of sense. But it meant that they couldn't just go off and do their own thing. There'd be plenty of Russians inside the Soviet Republic. And of course, there was a tension even in the Soviet era between Ukrainian based people, like Khrushchev was a Ukrainian. So one of the things he did in 1954, when he got fed up of some kind of internal fight they were having in the top of the Communist Party, he made Crimea part of Ukraine as a way of, maneuvering within the Central Committee at the time. Now, even at the time, the Ukrainians, there were no big Ukrainian speaking population in Crimea. The Ukrainian speaking population, which is Ruthenian, the language, really, it's not called Ukraine, it's called Ruthenian. They're mostly in the west of the Ukraine. And in the west of the Ukraine, the borders were decided by Stalin at the end of the war. Lvov used to be part of Poland before the war. But in the war, the Banderite militias aligned with the Germans murdered tens of thousands of Poles, Jews and Russians who were living in the city of Lvov, which is why it's called Lviv today, because it's a Ukrainian city.
And so we could go back even further, couldn't we? Back to the 1850s. Crimea was a big tug of war then. It looks to me powers for centuries, certainly for many, many decades, have seen Crimea as the key to destroying Russia.
Well, that's right. And of course, the Crimean War was, people say, Ben Wallace was saying that he was from the Scots Guards, and the Scots Guards kicked the Russians backside back in 1854. And I'm sure we could do it again. And he's won. There's a whole load of ex-British prime ministers and great and good like him who were pushing Keir Starmer to use British Storm Shadow missiles, even without the Americans or anybody else. We're prepared to go it alone. Boris Johnson has said so much. Keir Starmer's pushing the Americans. Why can't we just do it? And the Americans, to their credit, because the Pentagon are blocking it, say, well, no, because it might mean World War III, Keir. Now, I think Keir Starmer is actually out of his depth here. He don't know what's going on with this. I bet you if we had a conversation with him about the history of Crimea, he wouldn't know what we're talking about.
Well, someone else who's out of his depth by far is Bilderberger David Lammy. As I just for those that weren't listening last week, we have the venue and the dates in June next year for next year's Bilderberg conference, which is due to take place at the Grand Hotel owned by the Wallenberg family in Stockholm. This is where the Fascist International Fourth Reich like to meet. This is the Bilderberg conferences that I've spent probably the last 30 years or so looking into, investigating those. Martin, what do you make of this sort of concept of the Fascist International? Have oligarchs always been like this? They like to work across borders. I mean, the modern thing really since the Second World War has been transnational corporations, where national governments don't really seem to care that the companies that cross the borders are far more powerful than they are.
Well, I think we've got to be careful about use of language here. The Bilderberg Group and NATO did involve taking fascists like Bandera, the man who killed all those Jews and Poles in Lvov, as it then was. They took him under their wing. He was assassinated in 1959 in Munich, where he was living in comfort, by the KGB, because there was no attempt by the West to punish him for what he'd done. In actual fact, after the war, the Ukrainian far right, which had been aligned with the Nazis, were all taken en masse, their activists were taken en masse and resettled in the West. A lot of them ended up in Canada, which is why we had that guy turning up in the Canadian Parliament who had actually been in the Waffen-SS, because that's where they were all taken. And the Russians are very well aware of this. The Soviets were well aware of it. And the follow-on Russian, you know, modern Russian intelligence services are very well aware of this as well. Most people in the West are blissfully unaware of how Nazified NATO actually is. It started off as a soft version of Nazism. Reinhard Gehlen, who is the head of the East, the Gestapo, ends up running the West German intelligence services. Now, it doesn't make, you know, the Soviets could obviously work this out. This guy should probably have been hung at Nuremberg, and instead he ends up running the, and of course his sales pitch to the Dulles brothers and the CIA, people setting up the CIAs, I've got loads of spies inside the Soviet Union. If you kill me, you'll lose them all. Why don't you work with me to use my spy networks, and we'll work together to defeat the communists? And that's the root of the Cold War, actually, because the Russians at that stage, even Stalin, had some hope that we can come to some kind of understanding here about what we're doing. So, for example, Austria, which was occupied by the Russians, they withdrew as long as it was agreed that it was going to be neutral. And of course, Austria is still neutral today. And there's no problem.
Well, look, hang on. Austria's not really that neutral, is it?
No, they're in the pocket, but they're officially they're neutral.
Yeah, officially.
Finland was
so they have Bilderberg conferences. They have the Bilderberg conferences in Austria, etc. Anyway, look, Martin, I'm going to give you a choice now. We've got two clips coming up, both of which are relating to Ukraine and generally to British foreign policy. A very extraordinary thing happened, and I should have really had it on last week's show. Apologies, listeners. But this was the big press conference held by the MI6 and the CIA directors. Isn't it Bill Burns and Robert Moore from MI6, Bill Burns from the United States CIA. And so we've got that to delight you any moment. But we've also got David Lammy, the British Foreign Secretary, his speech on the climate crisis and how it relates to the various international conflicts. So I'm going to give the choice to you, Martin, as to which we hear first. Who do you think are more interesting to hear from, the two intelligence directors or David Lammy?
Well, let's hear from the bosses rather than the let's say the organ grinders rather than the monkey. Let's hear the intelligence.
Okay. So yeah, let's have a listen to Ukraine CIA Director Bill Burns and the MI6 Director General Richard Moore talking to the Financial Times' rather, it's clueless editor called Rula Khalaf. God knows how she's got the job, but she seems to me, like most editors in the London newspapers, is that they got the job because they don't know what's going on. So let's have a listen to that clip first. Bill Burns and Richard Moore, the two directors of the MI6 and CIA.
It's absolutely critical that we do sustain our support to Ukraine. And it's really difficult. It's hard. And particularly in eastern Ukraine, this is attritional warfare where there is a huge amount of suffering on both sides. And Putin is pushing forward in a sort of attritional Pyrrhic campaign of taking village by village as he goes forward. When he takes those, there's nothing left. I mean, that's why I used the, deliberately used the term Pyrrhic. There is nothing left because everything is utterly destroyed. But that is the Kremlin way of war. That's what they did in Grozny. It's what they did in Aleppo. And it's what they're now doing in it. So it is tough, but it's also important to remember that our Ukrainian friends have an absolute will to fight. And it's important to remember how this started. It started in this phase with Putin mounting a war of aggression in February 2022. And 2.5 years later, that failed. It continues to fail. The Ukrainians will continue to fight. We will continue to help them to fight. And it's difficult, there's no doubt at all. But a final comment. You know, the move into Kursk, it's too early to say how long the Ukrainians will be able to hang on in there and
Do you think that was a good idea, the move into Kursk?
Say it again, Rita.
Was that a good idea?
I think it's typically audacious and bold on the part of the Ukrainians to try and change the game. in a way. And I think they have, to a degree, changed the narrative around this. As we were saying, Putin pushing forward, grinding forward, village by village, and just having a sort of mentality that I'll just hang on to what I grab. I'm not interested in negotiations. I'll just, you know, just gradually increase it. The Ukrainians, by going in and taking Kursk, have really brought the war home to ordinary Russians. They are now, he has gone into this war 2.5 years ago. Not only has he seen things like NATO get two more members, he's now lost a part of his own territory. So I think, you know, we'll have to see how it develops. But I think it's bold, and it clearly, you know, should be supporting our Ukrainian friends.
So, Bill, I wanted to just ask you to comment on something specific about Putin. You've written that the Ukraine war is quietly corroding Putin's power, but also that his grip doesn't seem likely to weaken anytime soon. So which is it? Sometimes it seems to us that the Prigozhin rebellion was more of a time off, was more as a one-off.
I mean, I think what you've seen first, as Richard said, is the Kursk offensive is a significant tactical achievement. It's not only been a, you know, boost in Ukrainian morale, it has exposed some of the vulnerabilities of Putin's Russia and of his military, much as Prigozhin's short-lived mutiny a little more than a year ago did as well. It did raise questions on the part of people we could see across the Russian elite about where is this all headed. And that underscores the point Richard made that, you know, Putin's whole narrative right now is a very cocky, very smug one. It's time's on my side. It's only a matter of time before the Ukrainians are going to be ground down and all of their supporters in the West are going to be worn down, and I'll be able to dictate my terms. I think, you know, what these events have done, the Kursk offensive most recently, is to put a dent in that narrative. And it does raise questions in the Russian elite about what is all this for. If you remember the video that Prigozhin released the Friday morning of his mutiny, was as scathing an indictment as I've seen from anyone about Putin's conduct of the war. He said first, and this is someone who is very close to Putin and an intimate in this regime, he said three things. First, that there was no Ukrainian threat that prompted this war. That's all a lie. Second, he said, you know, the military conduct of the war, Russian generalship has been abysmal. And third, he said that corruption is the root of this political system. And that we could see at the time created some debate within the Russian elite. The Kursk offensive has prompted that too. Does that mean that Putin's on his last legs? No, I don't think either of us would.
Do you see his grip on power weakening?
I don't. I mean, I'll start. I don't see any evidence today that Putin's grip on power is weakening. He does one thing really well, and that's repress people at home.
So that's that extraordinary press conference with the director of MI6 and the director of, he's a director general, they call them, don't they? And the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. So both sides of the Atlantic, Martin, these two super spooks. In a way, I mean, before you say anything about what, you know, what they were saying about Putin, Prigozhin or whatever there in Kursk, the fact that they've come out into the spotlight sort of suggests that they're not getting their way in the media, doesn't it? These guys are supposed to be kind of behind closed doors, but they seem fit to go in front of the world's press here and air their thoughts.
Yeah, well, isn't it interesting? I mean, people never used to know who these people were. They used to hide behind the arras, but here they are. And it's because the one word they kept using there was narrative, narrative. The narrative, Putin's narrative, our narrative. And of course, what they deal in is why are they giving this press conference? It's to try and get nitwits like David Lammy and others to carry on supporting what they have cooked up, even though in actual fact they are losing. The Kursk intervention, I mean, the Guardian today, the Ukrainian PR people have handed the stuff to the Guardian saying that they've captured these documents that showed that in actual fact the Russians were aware that something was going to happen in Kursk. And in other words, they've also, in a way, for people like me, shot themselves in the foot, because some of the debate, the stuff I'm reading on the internet, is that maybe the Russians were happy for them to cross the border into Kursk, because they're not going back. They can't retreat. This is their best troops, and they're now in a cauldron. And that once they've sealed that cauldron off, they're either going to die or surrender. Also, of course, I've been reading that this has been all over Russian television. People have been speaking to the media. The mercenaries in that group have been particularly brutal. They've been shooting people, raping women. And of course, they're saying that if we hit the Russian people hard enough, like we did at the Crocus attack on the theater, the so-called jihadis that did that are in custody. But they were fleeing not to the Caucasus, but to Ukraine. And of course, most people in Russia have drawn the conclusion that these jihadis and the neo-Nazis in the Ukrainian army, they are all, in fact, the Western intelligence services. I mentioned Zakhachenko earlier, who was the elected prime minister of the Donbass Republic. There was supposedly a ceasefire on. He gets his head blown off, probably by people that well known to Richard Moore and Bill, whatever his name is. So,
what about what they were saying about Putin? Do you think his position in reality is stronger now?
I think it's as strong as it's ever been. The problem they've got is they think that if they hurt the Russian population, they've not managed to do it because real wages are rising in Russia. They're having a bit of a boom. The problem with the war is because the economy's booming. They don't want to send everybody off to fight because then, you know, the economy will go down the drain. So they've got to get a balance there. But the fact is that they haven't achieved that. They've tried to make life miserable for ordinary Russians. A, they haven't succeeded. And B, even if they did manage to make it miserable for them by killing them, which is what happened at the Crocus theatre attack and various other attacks that have carried out, like the assassination of Dugin's daughter and so on, and the attempted assassination of Putin in St. Petersburg, the Russian population ain't stupid. They have media like we have. We don't have access to their media, so we don't know what they think. But we could and should be listening to the general opinions of ordinary Russians. And they are fed up with being treated as a whipping boy by the West. And after the invasion of Kursk, for example, they're recruiting people for the Russian army. They had 30,000 people turn up outside the recruiting stations the next day.
Well, I'm not sure if you've seen these stories about Western mercenary units, whole groups of mercenaries being captured in Kursk.
That's right. A lot of the people that went into Kursk are, in fact, some of them are Brits, some of them are Poles, some of them are Americans. Now, and of course, the other thing that happened, which hasn't been mentioned, is last week or the week before, not long ago, the Swedes were training Ukrainian air crew in using their new kit because they've joined NATO now, you see. And one of the first things they did was they sent their people to train the Ukrainians in how to use this new kit, these AWACS that they've got. And the Russians just waited till they're all in the one place. And then they put in a couple of Kinzhal missiles and killed hundreds of them. And it was actually done in Poltava, which is on the anniversary of the Battle of Poltava in 1709. In 1709, Charles XII.
This is in Ukraine, I take it, in Western Ukraine.
It's in Ukraine today. Yes, back in those
Western Ukraine. Or where is that?
It's in Eastern Ukraine.
Oh, in the east. Okay.
But it's traditionally part of the Russian Empire. And in 1709, the Swedes were trying to capture the Russian Empire. So that, you know, the Swedes were imperialists in that era. Yeah, they were trying to, you know, they were after the 30 Years' War, they'd become a major power, and they were trying to take over. And at the Battle of Poltava in 1709. They were defeated, and that was the end of Swedish imperialism. But the Kinzhal strike on these mercenaries, you know, they weren't mercenaries, they're actually, you know, serving members of the Swedish armed forces, was on the anniversary of the battle, in the place where the battle took place. And then the following day, the foreign minister in Sweden resigned completely out of the blue, said he was leaving politics. And the reports I'm seeing are suggesting that hundreds of NATO officers were killed in that attack.
Amazing. Well, look, I wonder if our own foreign secretary is going to be resigning for any of the stupid acts that he does in sending British lads of various sorts to die on the altar of US imperialism in Ukraine. So let's have a listen now to our own foreign secretary to see what we can make of his understanding of foreign conflicts and how they all relate. I mean, I couldn't quite believe that he wanted to make a foreign policy speech about how it all relates to climate change, but he did this week.
Nature has been declining 30% less and 30% more slowly in indigenous lands than in the world as a whole. Evidence shows that putting local communities at the center of decision-making leads to better outcomes for the natural world. This is the model of development that I believe in. The modernized approach to development this government will be implementing. The spirit of partnership, not paternalism, in action. For me, this is deeply personal. Far from here, in Guyana's rainforests, lie Sophia Point. I established this small conservation center 5 years ago with my wife in one of the last unspoilt biodiversity hotspots in the world. It was fascinating and a huge privilege for me to discuss this with Sir David Attenborough last week and hear his reminiscence of visiting Guyana, the same rainforest, as a young man. I told Sir David that his first book, Zoo Quest for Guyana, which came out in 1956, which was the year that my father emigrated here to Britain. In fact, my father used to bring me to Kew Gardens. I mean, I look back, he's now not alive, so I can't ask him, but I now realize that the reason he brought me here was to somehow be in touch with Guyana and those rainforests. And we discussed how Sir David's work and that of Sophia Point is rooted in a concept common to indigenous people of that part of South America, and many farmers and others in Britain and around the globe, stewardship of the natural world. We have both an interest and a responsibility to maintain a livable planet for ourselves and for future generations. That is our goal. Ultimately, there will be no global stability without climate stability, and there will be no climate stability without a more equal partnership between the global north and the global south. For Britain to play its part, we must reset here at home and we must reconnect abroad. And that is what this government will deliver, so that together we can build a better future for all. Thank you very much indeed.
That's Foreign Secretary David Lammy there. Martin, it's really interesting, I think, the way he's saying, well, look, you know, we can't have global stability without climate stability. And he's really seeing this as a sort of battle between the developed world and the developing world, between north and south. But at the same time, being reported on LBC today that secret permission for Ukraine to fire missiles inside Russia is going to be given in the coming weeks. Lammy is very much at the centre of all of this. So, I mean, it just sounded to me a little bit like a kind of silly fairy story, him talking about what's going on with David Attenborough in Africa, where actually we're on the verge of a potential strike against Britain if the secret permission is given for Ukraine, secret or not. I suppose the aim is to keep it secret from the British public. To actually hit Russia with the Storm Shadow missiles deep inside their own country.
Well, I think Guyana is in fact in South America, so, and I think he probably comes from Guyana, which is why he's making the deal out of it. So it's the usual, you know.
Sorry, I thought you said Ghana, but you might. Yeah, I'm sure you're right.
Guyana, it's Guyana, and of course he's what he's doing there is the. I because of my personal experience, I understand the issues, blah de blah de blah. I was just reading actually an article this week that says there's this idea that indigenous populations protect their in areas where indigenous populations have been allowed to persist, the biodiversity is infinitely better than elsewhere. Now I'm willing, indigenous people should be allowed to have their way of life. I'm not got any problem with that whatsoever. But the idea that they and they alone can protect the biodiversity is simply wrong. It's a canard which has been circulating on the internet for several years, and somebody did some research, and I haven't got it to hand, and they looked into the original thing was just somebody kind of made it up. It sounded right, you know, if indigenous people are allowed to keep their lands, then probably the biodiversity is going to be better. But there was no evidence for it. It was just an assertion, you know. And of course, it fitted in with, if you like, the hippie philosophy, which I used to identify with, and I haven't entirely stopped identifying with. But in a world where we're just about to have a nuclear war, and there's a genocide that we are supporting, and probably if we do fire these Storm Shadow missiles, Britain on its own into Russia, then Britain on its own may get a punishment beating, and we may get that punishment beating before Christmas. That'll be a nice little Christmas present from Mr. Putin, who in fact is not going to lose power. He just won an election earlier this year with an overwhelming vote. David Lammy represents a government that got 34% of the vote. And when the missiles come in and people start dying, then maybe it's the British people that are going to rise up against their government and say, what are you doing? Yeah. I don't see anybody queuing up to go and fight in Ukraine.
I think this is
outside Bristol. Bristol Army.
No, I don't either. But isn't this what they call inversion? The idea is whatever they're accusing the other side of, they are actually up to it themselves. Look, another thing, obviously, this is lots and lots of propaganda going on. But another big story is this Jewish Chronicle meltdown this week. Robbie Gibb, who is responsible for turning the Jewish Chronicle into a right-wing pro-Netanyahu propaganda rag, according to William Dalrymple, is one of five people, including the Director General, who's on the BBC News Editorial Guidelines and Standards Committee. Minutes of the last meeting show they discussed complaints about Israel and Gaza, quite apart from the fact that this guy, Robbie Gibb, is not emotionally impartial on the Middle East. How can the major shareholder of a paper with such poor journalistic standards and extreme hawkish bias have a role over the BBC? So what do you make of this meltdown? Everyone is, you know, all of these, Zionist pro-Israeli commentators have now realised that they can't write for the Jewish Chronicle anymore because of the ownership is very opaque. And also, it's like rats leaving the sinking ship as part of the propaganda campaign by the Israelis in the UK, in the heart of Britain.
Well, I mean, there's a very good article about this from Bristol-based Jonathan Cook, which I read earlier, about this whole row at the Jewish Chronicle. And, of course, people like Jonathan Friedland, David Aronovich, David Baddiel have all resigned from the Jewish Chronicle because what they were shown to be doing is they put out a story that Hania, who's the leader of Hamas, is going to escape to Iran, and therefore there's no point negotiating with him. And they say that they got the information from the Israeli military. Now, the Israeli military want a ceasefire in Gaza, and they don't want to go to war in Lebanon. So they immediately scotched that and said, no, that's not true. That's all made up. And the guy who passed the story off to the Jewish Chronicle turns out to be a complete charlatan who claimed he'd been in the Israeli military when he hadn't, who claimed that he'd been at Tel Aviv University when he hadn't, didn't, his CV was totally made up. And he has been used as a conduit for Netanyahu's office to spread this information to the Jewish Chronicle so that then Netanyahu can say, well, the Jewish Chronicle is reporting that this is what the military in my country is saying. But the military, who are odds with Netanyahu, have said, no, we didn't say any of those things. That's not what we're saying. And therefore, they've been caught out. And therefore, these people have had to resign. But as Jonathan Cook points out in his article, there have been four successful libel cases against the Jewish Chronicle in recent years, and hundreds of upheld complaints for bias. Hundreds. Now, in actual fact, the press complaints authority in this country is a toothless nothing. So, but they, a small weekly magazine, have had loads and loads and loads of questions asked about what they're doing. They've lost loads and loads of, they've been slapped over the wrist, and they've lost four libel cases.
So what's this Robbie Gibb, editor guy at the Jewish Chronicle, doing on the BBC Editorial Standards Committee?
Well, that's right. That's why William Dalrymple and others are pointing out. I mean, this guy's got a track record of telling lies on behalf of Israel. Why is he on the BBC's? And he's on the committee that decides how we're going to report Gaza and Israel. Well, it's because they're dug into the infrastructure, just as was being pointed out earlier about who runs the music industry in the US. We're not talking about Jews here. We're talking about particular kind of Jews.
It starts to sound like these people are deliberate infiltrators, like intelligence agents or something.
Well, I mean, some of them are directly intelligence agents. They're employed directly by Mossad. Others are agents of influence, what they call psionim. And there's plenty of people who are just sympathetic to it because they are. And it's, you know, the Zionists are very well organised. They've got very big resources.
No, I suppose they have money to give. They have money. I mean, it's basically, yeah, I mean, it's a Zionist gravy train. Anyway, look, we're starting to wind up now. So let's go to our final story, which is the alleged would-be Trump assassin who said in his book that he looks forward to World War III. This is Ryan Wesley Routh. He wrote that he hoped to be the one that burns down the Kremlin. A 58-year-old man arrested on Sunday for allegedly trying to kill former President Donald Trump. He said he hoped he could burn down the Kremlin. He looked forward to World War III. I do dream of the day, he said, that we cross over into Russia and march towards Moscow. That's the part of this Third World War that I look forward to. I want to be the one that burns down the Kremlin and all the cruelty that it signifies. He wrote in the book entitled Ukraine's Unwinnable War. He also criticised Trump for pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, and he said he must share the blame for voting for the former president. I must take part of the blame for the retarded child we elected for our next president. But anyway, what do you think? This was a serious assassination attempt?
I've read an article about this one by Kevin Barrett earlier, and he thinks, I mean, he analyses all of this stuff about the history of the guy. He thinks that the original attempt on Trump was probably a fake, you know, to help Trump. But he doesn't think about this about this.
No. Well, he's completely.
All right, I'm just giving some information to the listeners.
Right, fine. Yeah. Okay. Think,
yeah. If he is, he's either alone. I mean, he sounds like a pretty nutty person. Actually, if you look at his history, he's somebody who's got mental health issues. He thinks of himself as some kind of radical. He's in his 50s. He turned up in Ukraine and said he wanted to join the Foreign Legion and said, no, you're too old. He then set himself up as, you know, on the internet to, you know, he's a fantasist, potentially dangerous fantasist, you know, but in the United States, it's quite easy for dangerous fantasists to get all the weaponry. There's another question, of course, which is, Trump only decided to go to that golf course at the last minute, but he was ready there at the golf course. How did he know where to be?
Yeah, he got around about 300 yards from Trump with his rifle. So, and he was shot at
on the golf course because Trump
was shot. Yeah, he was shot at.
So he was shot.
He was shot at. He was shot at by the Secret Service people in order to. Not actually at him, but next to him in order to convince him to give up his gun. At least he managed to survive, unlike, well, mind you, the whole situation was far more critical. The last one was actually in the process of shooting at Donald Trump. Patrick Henningsen did an interesting tweet about the shooter. He calls him the latest daily shooter to target Trump, a curious character called Ryan Routh. As we will show you here, he's hardly incidental in the story. He could be many things. Let's just go with the general heading of assets, informants, dupes and other useful idiots. Below is a video he features in, which is clearly a planted story for Newsweek Romania, filmed in Kyiv in June 2022. This is part of a US intelligence op or forward information operations intending to promote the idea of a spontaneous grassroots recruitment drive for soldiers of fortune to go and fight the good fight in Ukraine, an operation roughly modelled after the International Brigade in Spain in the 1930s and not unlike similar CIA-led AstroTurf recruitment for NATO's Gulf-backed Mujahideen foreign fighters in Syria between 2011 and 2019. For those that are not aware, US outlets like Time and Newsweek have been traditionally used by the CIA for propaganda and limited hangouts for international audiences, especially for active US, UK covert action theatres like Syria and Ukraine. The Ryan Routh story is another prime example of this. Based on this, then it's not a stretch to conclude he's most likely an asset or useful idiot who's on the books to be deployed for specific roles this latest incident in Florida being his swan song. So I think Patrick's actually hit the nail on the head there. The fact that he's appearing in these recruitment videos for Ukraine right at the very start, Martin, is really, it just says, it says to me that Patrick's right, that this guy is a CIA asset.
Well, the only counter argument I would put to that is because he's so pro-Ukrainian, he could be a Ukrainian asset. You know, the Ukrainians who might, it's Zelensky who might want Trump dead, because Trump said he's going to cut off the supply of weaponry or money once when he comes to power. But if you're going to assassinate Trump, you don't want him. I mean, Sirhan Sirhan, who supposedly murdered Robert F. Kennedy, he was a Palestinian. And he was a patsy, yeah. But of course, it's actually probably the Israelis who murdered RF Kennedy. That's why we've got a Palestinian patsy. It's unlikely the Ukrainians will put a Ukrainian patsy in there. It may just be, in this particular case, that this guy is just one of those nutty people. But as I say, how did he know that Trump was coming to the golf club? Well, this is the sort of thing that you need John Wedger and the police to look into.
It's he sells some sort of inside information. Quite right. Yeah, definitely some sort of inside information. Anyway, time to wind up now. And I think we'll finish this week with going back to New York to the United Nations. And isn't it wonderful that the Neturi Carta also got a synagogue in New York? And these are the genuine Jews who are proper Orthodox Jewish, but they are very, very adamant that what's going on over in Israel right now is completely wrong. And so let's finish up this week. And it's not really quite they're the opposite, really, of the Chabad Lubavitch people. But let's have a listen now to Neturi Carta giving their United Nations press conference at the march, and actually they did their own march as well, at the United Nations for Gaza on Wednesday, as a sort of backdrop on the streets of New York to this UN vote, which was so unanimous, larger than a two-thirds majority, condemning the Israelis and demanding a ceasefire, and also, as Martin has said, representation at the UN for the Palestinians.
Many people who are involved in supporting this state of Israel, you'll ask them, why are you doing this? And they'll tell you, well, where was God to protect us? Where is God? So they spew blasphemy. The whole root of creating a so-called Jewish state, ironically, sadly, is rooted in scoffing at laughing, belittling the Jewish people who turn to God for protection. They say, no, where's God? We need a gun. And that in and of itself, the root of this state is really heresy and a contradiction to my religion of 3,000 years, where we always look to God. We believe God is the ruler of the world. He's compassionate, and he is the one who we look to for help. We may not understand his ways. We do not understand the tsunami. We do not understand the plague. But we understand that we don't question that there is a ruler to the world, and it's his world. He does what he wants. And we have to, and he's compassionate. We turn and plead, and we pray to him constantly for protection, for compassion, for good for the world. As it's coming in 2 weeks from now, with me, it's coming the high holidays, where we're going to say in our prayers that he should put in the hearts and so and minds of the leaders that they should strive for peace, that they should strive for harmony, they should strive that the world should live together in peace. And that's our prayers. Zionism is in its essence contradictory to Judaism, but since 2,000 years ago, since the destruction of the temple, we are expressly forbidden to reestablish, to create any Jewish sovereignty, and we have obeyed this. For 2,000 years we went through the Crusades, the Inquisitions. We never attempted to establish a state. Who were the fathers, the ones who made the state? Theodor Herzl, Ben Gurion, Chaim Weizmann, all these people who did not practice the religion, they wanted a national home, and they simply masquerade in the facade of my religion. They use the Star of David. They use the name Israel in order to intimidate and silence anybody who wants to stop what they're doing when they're impeding on the rights of God's human beings, the people of Palestine. When you say anything to them, say, oh, how dare you? Don't you see in the Bible? And then they have the second weapon, their nuclear weapon, which is called anti-Semitism. What is the word anti-Semitism? My grandparents were killed in Auschwitz. My mother's family was from Poland. My father is from Hungary. And my father escaped when the Nazis came into Hungary. His parents were killed, were burnt in Auschwitz. They were gassed in Auschwitz. The Nazis were anti-Semitic. They wanted to eradicate Jews. The world, thankfully, turned around and said, we made a red line. If somebody is going to attack a people because they're black, they're racist. That's wrong. They're going to attack people because of their religion. If they're Jewish, they're anti-Semitic. So this word is a word that's powerful, and it's to accomplish on this world. Comes the Zionists. For their selfish reasons, they take that word and they make a state in a land that's not theirs, and they turn around, and if you dare say anything against them, they say you are anti-Semitic. They are nullifying the word anti-Semitism. They are making it powerless. How dare they take the ashes of my grandparents and the millions of Jews who were killed and nullify what happened over there?
So that's Rabbi David Weiss from Neturi Carter outside the United Nations earlier this week, winding up this week's program. I had hoped to do some stuff on COVID, but we'll have to do that next week. There's been a fascinating, and I'll put a link up to it, I guess, on our show page, which is a really interesting article about how to, shall we say, mitigate some of the problems in your body if you've had the COVID jabs, which I think is an excellent piece of work. Peter McCulloch, I think, has done it. And also I've had it looked over by other experts who have also endorsed it. And so that a link to that will be up on our show page anyway. And Patrizia Opulenza has done a rather nice poem about that, which we're at here next week, back in Bristol. So for now, that's all for this present show. Time to sign off. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to former Metropolitan Police detective and investigator of child sexual abuse extraordinaire John Wedger, who was booted out for his trouble about being honest, and also, of course, the sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send us interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page. We'll also find the podcast full-length interviews, story tips and comment page. And you can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter if you can afford it. You can also donate and set up a small monthly subscription at thisweekoneword.org.uk, but the principle is this is a free program. You only need to do that or even think about it if you've got the spare cash to do so and you feel so inclined. The idea is it's a donation if you wish. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You'll find me on there a fair bit and on other social media, Facebook, etc. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11, 8 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. We hope at the moment it's not working 100%, but roughly those times you'll hear the show repeated, and also over Sunday breakfast at Camberley's Radio QUK.com. Do please feel free to make live recordings. So we have been streaming live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at Radio QUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you haven't downloaded that already, grab it. Nick is a great developer, and you can even, if you think, oh, this I think should be an improvement, or this isn't working quite right, Nick is absolutely up for redesigning the app just for you. That's how personal things are on here. This is all a bit homemade, but it works. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing an enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Nikad nisam bio pjevač Beatlesa ni Stonesa i moje ruke rijetko sežu do samog sunca i nije važno kad sam gore i kad me slave, ja sam nitko i ništa bez njene krvi plave. Jer ja nikad neću biti nikad, ja nikad neću biti nikad, ja nikad neću biti velik ni ja. Ja nikad nikom neću priznat da je volim,
samo je stalno kuca mu san, pa da je boli. A kad sam propao i sam, to ona jedina skuži, plava krv anđela u mojoj ruži. Jer ja nikad neću biti nikad, ja nikad neću biti nikad, ja nikad neću biti velik nijak. Ja nikad nisam bio pjevač Beatlesa ni Stonesa i nikad neću biti vlasnik miliona novca, jer ja sam njegovog veličanstva zla vojnik u službi. Kristalno zvoni moj slan dok je gubim. Jer ja nikad, ja nikad neću biti nikad, ja nikad neću biti nikad, ja nikad neću biti. Oh,